Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, I'm going to talk about the Republican Poverty Tour, reportedly heading to Pittsburgh. And not a second too soon, because you'll remember last week it was announced that 15 food pantries are going to be closing. Maybe Chairman Reed and the Republican Policy Committee and their big listening tour, maybe they can help. Or, you know, maybe some inspirational talk about bootstraps. Maybe that's what they'll bring. Also going to be talking about the assault on our safety net as food stamps, the idea, the law, 49 years old, coming up here at the end of the month. We'll talk about that. Also, the Spicoli lookalike. I still think it was a plant. It was a setup, but we'll see. Going to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Some interesting leaked information. We'll see who the winners, the losers, and, well, we know where we stand in that. Also going to talk about the new legislative liaison at the Pennsylvania Department of Revenue, none other than A.T. Twitt, and more on gun owners. We'll talk about that as well. Also, your thoughts, your questions, comments, whatever is on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So we're coming up to the beginning of school. My daughter had her big orientation today where she went to the school that's not quite done. And I look at this, and I've been thinking about this project that they're doing at my kid's school that they've been building for some time now. We were told when it started, be done before school started. It would then be done a couple months in. Then it'd be maybe the end of the school year. My daughter was told, lockers middle of the first semester, lockers by Christmas, lockers by the end of January. Well, we don't know. You go, well, had you used union labor? Had you used a project labor agreement? Had you, a contractor that would hire better skilled workers? Maybe you would have kept falling behind. Just a thought. Something to consider. But what was interesting is one of the things that my daughter has caught on to, and maybe it's me, I don't know. Maybe it's my distrust of what goes on. Maybe it's my anti- harassment, leave me the hell alone mentality. But she said, Dad, that when I bring my gym clothes to school, I got to bring my gym clothes to school in a clear plastic bag. And I'm going, really? What about your book bag? She goes, no. If they make me carry a clear book bag, I'm staying home. I'll be homeschooled. I go, oh, really? Well, I mean, it's good to have the ability to take a strong stand, even if you don't control it. But, hey, good for you. I'm proud of her, though. I got to be honest. I think she's growing into a young lady who's going to stand up for herself and hopefully have the head on her shoulders that's just not going to blindly go along with the flock. That's my greatest hope for her, is that she will be a thinking, critical thinking citizen in this country. Because I'm telling you, every day you look around and you go, there's this creeping intrusion, and I know people love to point their finger, it's the government. No, it's us. If we allow it to happen, it's our government doing it. It's not the evil government. It's us. And I was looking at the newspaper the other day, and it a couple of the high schools around the state putting in more cameras. I guess there are going to be cameras all over the schools because, we got to keep an eye on those kids, just like in some school districts where they actually give the kids chips, because we need to track them. We need to make sure that we can find them. And I'm uncomfortable with that. In fact, I'm uncomfortable with a lot of the police state tactics. I'm uncomfortable. And I know, I've had so many people tell me, Rick, if you're not doing anything wrong, why does it matter? If you're not doing anything wrong, why does it matter that there's a camera on every corner? If you're not doing anything wrong, why does it matter that every classroom and every place is going to have a camera? Because understand, to me, cameras, this is reality, cameras are after the fact. They're the response. They don't prevent anything. They're simply there to help clean up the mess at the end. They're reactive. They're not proactive. I mean, if you really wanted to stop violence, if you really wanted to stop crime, you'd hire more policemen. If you really wanted to stop crime and you really wanted to end poverty, you would add more resources and create more jobs. You'd give people opportunity and hope and all of that stuff. It's just much easier to put a camera up, though. And, of course, the camera companies love it because it's good for business. It's good profit. And I look at the statement that Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City, uttered on his radio program last week, which was all the rage on Friday's cable news. According to Bloomberg, you know, he said, well, you know what we should do? What we really should have is a fingerprinting to get into the public housing in New York. And his rationale was, evidently there are allegations. And that's what it all starts with. It starts with allegations. Allegations that some of the people who live in these buildings, well, they're not the people on the lease. So we should fingerprint them to get in the door. Instead of saying, well, what we should maybe do is, you know, have someone who fixes the locks so that the key gets in the door. Or, you know, maybe hiring a person to be in charge of the building that makes sure that the people, just a thought, you know, it's easier to say, well, what we want is we want fingerprints or biometric data. We want retinal scans. And there are those who believe that we should just be doing that as a matter of course. We should be taking all of this information because we can, creating a huge database so that we can solve crime after it happens, of course. But I look at this, and 620,000 people that live in the public housing in New York City. I'm thinking this could be a good job-creating thing. Just take the fingerprints, throw them away. Something to create jobs, right? Would you want to be the one fingerprinted? You know, I drive a truck on the weekends occasionally because, you know, I got to be honest, when I came back from our tour, I realized, you know, I miss driving. So I picked up a weekend gig where, you know, once in a while I'll take a little road trip. And to get that job, I had to go through the fingerprinting process. Because, you know, you could be a terrorist. And I remember saying back when they did that, I remember saying, look, you know, eventually it's, you know, they do it with the truck drivers first because they can, they're pliable. Then they do it with the poor because they're easy and they're pliable. And they don't really have the power and the resources to fight back. Eventually it's all of us. And I remember saying at the time, I remember saying back when they came out with the commercial driver's license back in 92, that, you know, this is going to be the way, this will be a national ID. Because my driver's license, I have a commercial driver's license. Mine is a federal driver. It is issued by the state, but the federal government oversees it. It's actually an international driver's license, really, because I can go into Mexico in theory. Thanks to our cross-border idea here that they're working through. And eventually we'll be able to drive in and out of Mexico if you don't get shot by the drug cartels or have your shiny bumpers ripped off. But I remember saying back then that this is the beginning of that downhill slough, that slog downhill, that long hill, because we're the first ones. And then when they came up with the GPS, they're going to put GPS in all the trucks. I said, eventually, it's going to work its way down to cars. And we find out now that a lot of the cars, it's already there. We just don't know it. There's going to be a push here in the very near future. Right in that little Dole light on the back of your car, that little cute little light up at the top of your windshield. Thanks, Elizabeth Dole. There'll be a camera. So when you back up, all cars will have to have backup cameras. And we do this stuff to ourselves. And eventually, they'll be able to hack into the camera and watch. And I know, Rick, you sound paranoid. No, I guess I've read too many of the sci-fi books growing up as a kid that I don't know people read anymore. I read 1984. I read a lot of Ray Bradbury stuff. I read a lot of those futuristic books that said, you know, this is what's going to happen in the future. And here it is. It's going on. So when I see these reports of putting more cameras in the schools, Bloomberg wants to fingerprint more people. Eventually it's going to be DNA. In fact, eventually they're going to take it at birth. Because we know someday you may commit a crime and we'll want to have the evidence right there. But I'm kind of stuck on the, well, if you don't do anything wrong, why do you care? And I go back to that little piece of paper. I go back to that piece of paper that says, I have all the rights. Innocent till proven guilty. The whole Fifth Amendment thing. That I don't have to testify against myself and give incriminating evidence. I know, if you're not doing anything wrong, why do you care? At what point does that creeping intrusion, where does that end? Does it end in your living room? I don't know. It just makes me uncomfortable. And to be honest, I'm glad to hear my daughter sees it as well. But I'm hoping for a very productive school year. The kids are excited, and I'm looking forward to it. I personally have always said that I think school should be a year-round endeavor, because I remember forgetting everything that I learned the year before and having to refresh the first 2 months of the following year. It would be better just to continually go. But you know what that would take? That would take a little bit of investment, and something that our governor and, well, states around the country, just not interested in. Sad, sad stuff. Anyway, as the poverty tour continues, I understand that Dave Reed and the Empowering Opportunities Initiative will be making its way into Pittsburgh. And as I said earlier, they're talking about cutting funding to 15 food pantries. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk with Ken Regal. He is the executive director of Just Harvest what I'm hoping to find is if Reed came to his organization and said, hey, tell us about poverty. I'm kind of thinking not, but it'll be interesting to find out, because I do have some hope that Chairman Reed is sincere in this. I mean, granted, they haven't shown me anything. I haven't seen. There was not one meeting, right? And I think they had an op-ed somewhere once. But, you know, here we are, you know, over a month now. Well over a month. And just one outreach. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in Pittsburgh, because Pittsburgh has one of the higher rates of poverty in the Commonwealth. So it'll be interesting to see where they go. Now take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk with Ken Regal, Executive Director of Just Harvest. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We want the world and we want it now. We're going to make it anyhow. We want the airwaves.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Modern-day sharecroppers on wheels will rally in Los Angeles in a Teamster effort to organize port drivers. Doug Cunningham reports.
The Teamsters, port workers, and supporters will rally in Los Angeles August 27th in the drive to organize port truck drivers. Nick Weiner is Port's campaign director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. He says the union has had some success at the ports, and drivers misclassified as independent contractors are fed up with pay and conditions and are more interested than ever in joining the Teamsters.
They're fed up. They're the modern-day sharecroppers just on wheels. Now drivers are taking notice at other companies. So what's happening in a couple weeks is a big rally in L.A., and leading the way are drivers at this company called Green Fleet. And some of their big customers are like Skechers Shoes and Huffy Bikes. They're coming together. They want to be treated fairly. And so we're going to have a big rally on the 27th.
Weiner says while conditions in overseas sweatshops are often horrific, much of the supply chain of imports is here on U.S. soil. So he says the Teamsters are focusing on helping workers here improve their conditions.
And there's jobs here that can't be outsourced, that can't be shipped overseas, that should be good, decent jobs. So that's what we're trying to do.
In less than 2 months, individuals will be able to start shopping for health insurance on marketplaces created under the Affordable Care Act. Wisconsin is one of the states that has chosen to forego setting up a state-specific exchange and instead is allowing the federal government to step in and do it. The Walker administration is expected to release information regarding health insurance rates by the end of the month. MIT economist Jonathan Gruber said in a conference call on Friday that when the rates are released, it's important to also factor in tax credits intended to reduce the cost.
By my estimate, the post-tax credit price falls by, you know, by about 5 or 6% in the state. And after you account for tax credits, the price in this market falls. Now, there are some winners and some losers. And the losers are essentially the people who have benefited from existing discrimination in this market. You've got Wisconsin has a highly discriminatory non-group market where young, healthy people can get excellent rates and older, sicker people are excluded and have to go to the high-risk pool where they pay expensive rates that are subsidized by the state. So it's not surprising that you end up with some losers. Anytime you end discrimination, the group that benefits from that discrimination will be worse off. That's the idea of ending discrimination, is to benefit the people who have been discriminated against.
Nearly half of the consumers expected to buy into the marketplace will receive tax credits.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need to cut the waste so we can keep taxes down and make sure we have money for critical programs that help our families and our seniors.
Cut that wasteful spending, you know, like health care. You need to cut that. You need to cut that wasteful spending, like the general assistance budget. Just get rid of it. Don't need it. So we have money for vital programs like giving corporations more tax cuts and more handouts. That's what we need to be doing more of, right? Absolutely. And as I look at Chairman Dave Reed, the Republican Policy Committee chairman, going around the state, you know, doing his anti-poverty tour. And as I've said 1,000 times, I hope he's sincere. I hope he is really trying to find the face of poverty, as he says. I understand his tour is going to Pittsburgh, which, you know, as we talked about, the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank is going to close 15 of their food pantries in the next month. And why is that? Well, most of it's funding cuts. Comes down to the dollars. And I know the Republicans love to say, well, we need to cut. But where do you cut and where is it reasonable? Here to help us talk about the poverty tour and what's going on in Pittsburgh, I've asked Ken Regal. He's the executive director of Just Harvest. JustHarvest.org is their website to talk about that. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, good evening.
You know, I look at this policy tour that the Republican chairman of the policy committee is going on. He's going to Pittsburgh. I guess my first question is, has the chairman or have the Republicans in their policy initiative, have they reached out to Just Harvest?
Well, in the last couple of years, I wouldn't describe what they've done as reaching out to us. But I do have kind of high hopes for this, for the poverty tour.
I'm hoping.
Dave Reed's office has, in fact, reached out to us, and we met with one of the staff people just the other day to talk about the plans and you know for what they're trying to explore and gain a better understanding of poverty on the ground. I am actually hopeful that this is a signal that they've discovered that what they've been saying for the last couple of years, waste, fraud, and abuse, is not in fact a solution to a problem that exists. The cuts they've made to key programs aren't actually accomplishing anything other than increasing human misery. And I think that they're starting to feel some pressure to respond in a much more real way to the ongoing crisis that poor people face in the state. And we're very hopeful that this is going to give us an opportunity to really be in a constructive dialogue.
Now, I'm hoping you're correct. Sadly, what I've seen, though, is from a portion of the Republican Party is the antithesis of what you've laid out. In fact, you know, the Daryl Metcalfs of the party, the people who I think have taken their party in the wrong direction, have said that this is the wrong direction, that, you know, stay the course, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. You know, those people are just lazy, basically lazy and stupid, and they need to work while not pushing a jobs plan, which I think, I've got to be honest, I think a transportation bill would go far in helping with poverty.
You would think, right? In investments in infrastructure, the creation of systems that actually help poor people have a chance at becoming, if not prosperous, at least having two dimes to rub together. these are the kinds of steps that traditionally have not really been partisan, and in recent years they've become much more sharply partisan. And I think this is really an opportunity for us to change the highly disciplined Republican consensus that had Dave Reed and Daryl Metcalf agreeing about everything related to poverty. I think what we're seeing now is the seeds of some discontent among Republicans with that, you know, the Daryl Metcalf line.
And I hope you're right.
I think if we can cultivate that and contribute to it, obviously the proof will be in the pudding about whether the Republicans that are part of the poverty tour are sincere, whether they're looking for authentically new ideas or for authentic evidence that their recent ideas have backfired for poor people, have done more harm than good, and that it would give them an opportunity to begin to back off some of the worst of those policy initiatives.
Do you think it's, because, you know, one of the things that came up out of the discussions I've had with a number of Republicans is that, you know, they believe charity is the only thing that we need, that government doesn't play a role in reducing poverty, and their view is that it should only be done through charity. Do you think that's reasonable? Do you think it's possible? Do you think we could, in this country, solely fund our social safety net through poverty or through charitable initiatives?
No. A friend of mine, Joel Berg, from the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, described trying to solve the hunger problem of charity as being like trying to empty the Grand Canyon with a teaspoon. I think that metaphor works in this particular political environment, where we're seeing the Republicans in Congress argue about whether $20 billion in food stamp cuts is enough, or whether they should press for $40 billion in food stamp cuts, when $20 billion exceeds the total amount of all charitable support for hungry people in this country.
Wow.
So the $20 billion cut in food stamps is akin to eliminating all charitable food distribution in America. That's the scale of what we're talking about.
That's
so
enormous.
To argue that charity can fill the gap is just foolishness, and this is third grade math to understand that you can't do that.
Well, what do you say to the people? Because you know, in talking with folks, you know that well, you should be able to take care of yourself, and this whole individualistic, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You should be able to do it alone. Mentality that has permeated you know, the mass of the GOP and some Democrats as well. What's your thought on that?
Well, if we had a country in which people actually could pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, if you had a country with a full employment economy, with a policy of making sure that anybody who wants a job can get one, and we'll put you to work in the public infrastructure setting if you're unemployed, if we had decent wages that could feed a family, save money for retirement, provide for a family's basic needs, then sure, we would only need social programs to provide for people with disabilities and associated problems that weren't economic in nature, but we don't have that.
Right.
That's not the world in which we live. And the advocates of everybody should pick themselves up by their own bootstraps can't have their cake and eat it too. They can't argue on the one hand that's what people should do, and on the other hand, we should do everything in our power not to create such an economy. We shouldn't have public investment in infrastructure. We shouldn't support the public education system. We shouldn't provide for people who have short-term needs. We shouldn't be generous to people with long-term disabilities and major life problems that require, a much deeper public level of support, because some people are just not going to be able to pick themselves up by their own bootstraps, and we've got an obligation to take care of folks. And it's one of the deepest ironies is that this is it's a largely a group of people who claim to be devoutly religious who say that, and I keep looking around for a religious tradition that teaches such things, and I haven't found one yet.
Well, I was told the other day, and I've been told numerous times, and maybe you'll find the humor in it, maybe you won't, that the Bible states you teach a man to fish, he'll eat for a lifetime. The only problem with that is that's not actually in the Bible.
Not in the Bible.
But there's a lot of people who believe that, Ken.
What it says in the Bible is that we are obligated to pay a worker fair wages, and in fact we have to pay him before the sun sets at night so that he can feed his family. That's what it actually says in the Bible.
I know, but you can't. There you go, spouting fact.
Yes, facts. Facts do get in the way, and I think getting back to Dave Reed and the poverty tour, the thing that makes me a little bit skeptical is that some of his rhetoric. Even the day he held the press conference to announce that the poverty tour was happening, he was using some of that, the exaggerated half-truth rhetoric about the failure of the war on poverty and the country spends $1 trillion a year, which is
$88,000 a person.
It's simply not true. That number comes if you include all of the nursing home bills for all of the poor people in the country and all of the not quite poor people in the country who are in long-term nursing care. And obviously it costs a lot more to take care of them than it costs to give them food stamps if they were walking around going shopping. It includes all of the middle-class people who get Pell Grants to go to college. It includes all of the earned income tax credit payments that go not only to poor working people, but to working people up to modest amounts of income. All of that gets called what we spend on poverty.
Right.
And then, so I think if you start out with half truths, it's hard to come up with good policies at the end.
Well,
so
for me, it's hard for me
to move him off of those. Of those half-truths.
Well, it's hard for me in his announcement back on the 15th of July. It was hard for me to hear him say that we find that most people living in poverty made one bad decision or one found themselves in one bad circumstance. And my thought on it is, most people, the bad decision was being born into poor families. That's the bad decision or the bad choice.
That's a bad decision that about one-third of all the people on food stamps in this country made. Another bunch of people made the bad decision to outlive their money. A lot of people made the bad decision to lose their job in the recession. And some people live in the wrong part of the country, right? Poverty is much deeper in some parts of the country than in others, and if you're underwater on your house, you can't move, you can't lose your health care coverage if you have it, if you're fortunate enough to have it, and so you can't leave a job that is a dead-end job, and the kinds of problems actual people face that have nothing to do with decisions of their own are staggering.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Ken Riegel. He's the executive director of Just Harvest in Pittsburgh. JustHarvest.org is their website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Do you think on this part, because I got to be honest, when he announced it, I was hopeful that he would go out and actually see people's faces. So when he goes to Pittsburgh, and I understand that's coming sometime this month, do you think he'll go to one of the 15 pantries that are going to be closed and see the faces of the people who are going to be affected by this? Because I got to be honest, there was part of me right at the beginning that was fairly hopeful that, maybe this is going to be more than just just sucking up per diems and mileage, and maybe this was about actually getting out and meeting people and understanding it. Do you think that's going to be part of this? How do you see things going in Pittsburgh?
I see some pros and cons there. I think that that the tour does authentically include some actual visits to actual grassroots community organizations and folks that are working very hard to serve poor people in need, at which he's going to encounter lots of poor people. The meeting that we're having the end of next week here in Pittsburgh is a meeting at the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank. My impression is that most of us in the room are going to be people who unfortunately have full-time jobs fighting poverty, rather than large numbers of people who are individually suffering. But some of those people have, believe it, vast personal experience with poverty in their own lives. They may have been able to turn that around and are now, you know, working for Just Harvest or working for the food bank. But I do think that Reed and the policy committee are sincere about visiting the environments in which poor people get help and meeting some poor people. I don't think, however, that the lives and experiences of poor people count for enough when it comes time for them to make decisions. There's no evidence that they made any effort to listen to poor people when they reimposed the asset test for food stamp eligibility, when they eliminated general assistance, when they decided not to provide expanded access to Medicaid. When they were making those decisions, those were the times they could have asked some poor people what they thought, and they made the decision not to.
Yeah, I mean, because for me, at the end of this,
best case, it's late in the day for the poverty tour.
Well, the cynic in me says this is a national scheme because we're seeing a lot of this stuff happening around the country to try and soften what the national Republicans, what they've done on a nationwide basis. It's part of the pushback against, you know, food stamps. Because we see on the federal level, we'll hand out welfare to the big agribusiness, but food stamps for working families and food stamps for people who need it, well, not so much.
So here in Pittsburgh, in the South Hills, the suburbs south of the city, Congressman Tim Murphy is a Republican congressman that represents that part of town. Voted for the $20 billion cut in food stamps that failed because a lot of Republicans didn't think it was enough. But he voted for the $20 billion in cuts. And the headline of his press release announcing that says, and I'm reading it right in front of me right now, Murphy votes to reform and strengthen safety net for low-income families and farmers.
Yeah, because he was only for taking $20 billion and not all 40. Had he taken all 40, he'd have been a bad guy. But, you know, since he saved that $20 billion, he's the king.
Cutting $20 billion. Well, his argument is that by getting rid of the bad policies, we protect these benefits for the people who really deserve them. And honestly, at Just Harvest, we're sick and tired of people who are classifying some poor people as deserving food and other poor people as not deserving food.
That's pretty amazing.
We don't think that distinction exists.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I never thought in my lifetime we would be having this discussion about who should and who should not eat. I mean, I thought we had come to a consensus that in the wealthiest country in the world, nobody should go to bed hungry at night.
It certainly seems like it ought to be one of our goals, and it's certainly achievable given our vast wealth and agricultural production. You know, we just have made it a decision, and that decision, unfortunately, is sometimes bipartisan, to make it harder and harder for poor people. The Democrats in the Senate signed off on a mere $4.5 billion cut in food stamps, and neither the $4.5 billion version nor the $20 billion version that failed in the House nor the $40 billion cut version that they're coming up with in a couple of weeks, none of those even include the money that's already being cut November 1 in everybody on food stamps in the country by an average of about 6% because of the expiration of the temporary increase that we put in place back at the worst of the recession. So now that unemployment is only down to 7.4%, we don't need that that extra help in the food stamp program anymore.
Yeah, so you're not quite as hungry anymore. So don't.
Well, you are if you just became eligible for food stamps in July. Finding out that November is when the increased benefits expire because it was only temporary is going to be pretty shocking to the person who just lost their job last month.
Now, what do you say to the person who's saying, well, you know, but we're giving out more food stamps than ever? Because I've gotten a bunch of emails from people saying, well, you know, especially the one that's gone around that says, you know, we're proud of, you know, feeding 46 million people, but the National Park Service has posted a sign at all the national parks, don't feed the animals because they'll become dependent on you. There are people that I run into every day who say we shouldn't be feeding because they'll become dependent.
Well, some of them do. Steve Fickner, for instance, is a guy who's dependent on federal benefits in the Farm Bill. He's a congressman from Tennessee who for the last 18 years in a row has never received less than $80,000 a year from farm subsidies for his family's giant farm. And he's a piker compared to a guy in a congressman in California, whose name I can't remember, unfortunately, at the moment, who's done even better on farm subsidy money. Now, both of them voted for the farm bill that included those farm subsidies but cut $20 billion from food stamps because people will become dependent. So the average amount of time that people spend on food stamps is about 8 months. So who's the culture of dependency?
Good question. And you look at Fincher and, you know, the reality is, you know, he's not the only one. I mean, there's a bunch of them, and it's just not the, you know, there's a bunch of them who, you know, they've been lining their pockets for years. Sad. Just sad. And this is my thing on this. You know, cause I have a bunch of people who say, you know, Rick, you know, there are people who, like the guy that Fox News had, and I still think that was a setup. I still think they dug him up and there's going to be a backstory to that eventually. But, you know, there's this one guy, and they want to throw the whole system out because they found one person, not realizing that it helps millions of people.
You know, there's 47 million people on food stamps. Are all of them nice people? Probably not. There's probably some very unpleasant people that you wouldn't want to hang out with among those 47 million people. And if we had a rule that said only nice people can get food stamps, that would be like a whole different kind of system. But that's not what we have. We have a country that says we're going to have a program that takes care of people, and if you meet these eligibility requirements, we will help you buy enough food to live on. You know, when it turned out that bags of cash totaling $100 million were in the hallway of being left unattended in the hallway of Hamid Karzai's brother in Afghanistan, none of the right-wingers that want to cut food stamps because of waste, fraud, and abuse said, well, we better change all of American foreign policy related to Afghanistan because of this waste, fraud, and abuse going on. They said, well, that's okay because, you know, he may be an unpleasant guy, but he's our unpleasant guy.
Yeah, good point.
So, you know, if we can give the congressman from Tennessee $80,000 in farm supports, and we can give the president of Afghanistan's brother bags of cash, then coming up with $135 a month for the average person on food stamps, seems like we could manage to do that, even if there's a little, very, very small percentage that gets wasted.
Right.
And, you know, worst case scenario, you know, you waste a couple of percent. You know, it's not like
and it's still good for the economy.
It's not like profitable businesses don't waste money. You know, I've been to a Christmas party at a big law firm, or or seen the conference room furniture at a Fortune 500 company. You know, a lot of money gets wasted.
So let me ask you a last question I've got for you. Now, who's the face of food stamps? I mean, you know, Fox News is trying to make it Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Who is the face? I know that, you know, the people when they talk about, when Reagan talked about the welfare queen, it was basically, you know, an African-American woman driving a Cadillac. Who is the real face of food stamps, though?
Well, that's a great question, because there's 40 million people, 47 million people on food stamps. They don't all have one kind of face. You can't name a category of Americans that aren't well represented among people on food stamps. They've got all the same faces as everybody else. So when it comes right down to it, more food stamp recipients in this country are children,
yep,
or elderly people or disabled people or people who have full-time jobs. That makes up those groups, children, old people, disabled people, and full-time workers, make up somewhere around 75 to 80% of people on food stamps in this country. And they have every different kind of face, from very newborn faces to very, very old faces.
And it's not just what we've been force-fed. Ken, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you very much.
Ken Riegel, Executive Director of Just Harvest. Again, their website, justharvest.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Oh, 90% of the world, we're new to them. Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people, oh, 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The voters, damn them, have got to be subverted. You won't find that autocratic principle taught in any civics class, but it's one that America's corporate powers openly embrace when local democracy offends them. Just ask the voters of Orlando, Florida, who recently felt the sting of such arrogance. A grassroots coalition called Organize Now had collected 50,000 signatures last year to put an earned sick time referendum on their county's November ballot. It was to be a citizen's vote on whether employers should let workers earn a few days each year of paid leave to be used if they fall ill or must care for a sick family member. Whoa, shouted the bosses of Disney World, Olive Garden, Red Lobster, and other super wealthy low-wage corporations in Orlando that provide minimal or no benefits. We can't allow that. So they leaned on the county commissioners to knock the referendum off the ballot. However, the scrappy Organize Now bunch took them to court and won. The people's victory was too late for last year's election, though, so the court ordered that the referendum be put on the 2014 ballot. So, all set, right? Not so fast, shouted the corporate powers as they scuttled off to Tallahassee, demanding that the GOP governor and state legislative leaders deliver a, quote, kill shot to those pesky voters back in Orlando. Sure enough, the obsequious corporate-hugging politicos obliged in June by enacting a brutish, democracy-smashing law called state preemption. It autocratically usurps the right of local governments and local voters to enact paid sick leave benefits. This is Jim Hightower saying, still, it's not over, for the corporate subversion of the people is not real popular, and maybe not even legal. Organize Now is pushing back and pushing ahead. Keep up with them at www.orgnow.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Of course, if there's comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. During the break, Randall sent me an email writing that, and that annoying Fourth Amendment that is practically non-existent now. You know, talking about my earlier rant about invasion and privacy. You know, the right of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, in effect, against unreasonable search and seizures. Remember that? That whole shall not be violated thing? And no warrant shall be issued, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation. Remember that? Describing the place to be searched and the persons and things to be seized. Remember that? I guess our NSA forgot about that. I know. Oh, but Rick, if you have nothing to hide, why does it matter if they're looking at your emails? Why does it matter if they're listening to your phone calls? And, you know, there's some argument there. You know, why does it matter? If you're not doing anything wrong, why would you care? I just do. Simply said. Anyway, under the guise of we're going to make Pennsylvania the Texas of the Northeast, since our governor, again, defund education, hand out, you know, huge money to the drillers, no transportation bill, interesting story popped up today from Texas, the Texas Tribune. Evidently, Texas is going to be converting about this 80 miles of road that is now currently paved. They're going to convert that into gravel. They don't have the money to keep the road up, so they're going to chew it up and make it a gravel road, which I guess will lower the speed limits down to about 30 miles an hour. And, you know, hey, who cares? It's just those rural people who have to deal with that. Because, you know, it's all about the urbans. You know, those farmers and ranchers, they're not too happy about it, but hey, heck with them. Now, according to America's Infrastructure Report Card, Texas is home to, well, evidently 38% of their roads are in poor to mediocre condition. 38%. And you go, well, you know, Pennsylvania, not all that great up there themselves. In fact, you know, you look at some of the reports, according to the same report card, we've got some serious road problems as well. Our bridges are in trouble. In fact, over 5,500 of our bridges are structurally deficient, almost a quarter, actually. Almost another 20% functionally obsolete. You look at our roads. 57% of Pennsylvania roads are in poor or mediocre condition. So actually, Texas is a little bit better off. We should be saying, they should be saying, Texas, the Pennsylvania of the Southwest. What do you think? Wow, I didn't realize our roads were, I guess it is true. I guess all of those truck driver magazines and all the truckers I've known over the years, it really is true. Pennsylvania does have the worst roads. Huh. We'll figure that out. Good news today for the Department of Revenue, Tea Party, a faithful, the woman who is the founder of the Kitchen Table Patriots, who claims Obama is a Marxist, claims he was born in Kenya, and defended a Nazi memorabilia dealer. She has been named as the legislative liaison for the Department of Revenue, which ought to be interesting. Again, someone who doesn't believe in government making over $68,000 a year, hired back on August 12th to run the Department of Revenue. Get this. You're going to run the Department of Revenue, but you don't believe in taxes. again, I go back to, I'm a brain surgeon, but I don't believe in surgery. I'm a brain surgeon, but I don't believe in the brain. what have we done? Anyway, the founder of the Kitchen Table Patriots. That'll be interesting. I would love to have followed her on her first day and see what kind of directives came out of the legislative liaison. Can you, I mean, really, stop and think about this for a second. Yeah, can you be anti-tax and still run and still be part of the Department of Revenue? Because if people know that you don't believe in taxes, do they just stop paying it? Again, it comes down to investment. For me, it comes down to investment. I look at this Republican congressman from New York, Michael Grimm. He told Fox News over the weekend that the idea of that Obama has to fund high-speed internet in every classroom in the country. He said Obama has an agenda, and he's going to do what he has to do to get that agenda passed, regardless of the Constitution. He said, quote, I mean, I think our founding fathers are turning over in their graves now because he's just so blatant. And the administrators, the people he puts in charge of these agencies are bold and brazen, saying, yes, we're going to make an end run around Congress because you won't do anything. No investment is being done. Nothing. And not just in Washington, but here in Harrisburg as well. And I come back to this and I go, you know, everyone agrees. The internet, it's here to stay. It's the future of the country. It's the future of international communication and commerce. Why don't we already have this in every classroom? Why haven't we made this investment? And look, I understand people like Congressman Grimm, they're going to be fine. And I hear this argument from people all the time. Well, you know, the schools are Taj Mahals. Well, understand. Technology is changing. My daughter has to buy a calculator in sixth grade that I didn't have to buy till my senior year to do trig. Ask me anything I learned in the trig class, and I can't even tell you the name of the textbook, let alone what I learned. But I was in 12th grade when I had to buy one of these calculators, and I got to be honest, they were god-awful expensive. Now they're like 15 bucks. Because when I saw it, I saw the paper come home, I'm going, really? Those are like $200 calculators. And my producer, Brett, goes, no, they're like 15 bucks. What century did you live in? Well, the century where they were $200. But here in sixth grade, that's the technology they're using. So understand that as we're moving forward, technology moves forward, and you have to invest in that. And for him to say, well, the founding fathers would be turning in their grave because he supports high-speed internet in classrooms is ludicrous. But it shows how ridiculous they've gotten. And I got to be honest, I hope it turns and bites them in the behind. And I think you're seeing some of that. I think you're seeing the fissures in the Republican response to a lot of things. And where I hope Ken is correct in the last segment is I'm hoping that he's right. I'm hoping Dave Reed, and I'm hoping some of the Republicans, maybe they're seeing it politically as a loser to continue down the path that the party's going. Maybe they do. You know, maybe that's what it's going to take to get some rational thought. Maybe. I don't know. Personally, I have quite a bit of disbelief. I have quite a bit of thoughts that this is just going to be more of the finger pointing. You made a bad decision. Yes, you were born. And it's just going to be a PR stunt. And there's part of me that goes, well, you know, it's the per diem. You know, you got to rack up the mileage, right? I don't know. You know, I think about this stuff, and it's infuriating on a number of levels. And you know, we're fed this. You know, over the weekend, you know, over the last couple of weekends, I've been doing this, you know, going back to driving because, you know, I miss it. And you know, it's good to go out and to talk to people that I've, you know, basically forgotten over the years, and to get their take on things. And this past couple of weekends have just been so eye opening. The way the way some of the people that I've met think about this country scares me. Because we've been told repeatedly, up is down, down is up, front is back. We've been told that, you know, the private sector is always the right idea. We've been told, and, you know, I was talking to a guy who delivers mail. And he actually, now he doesn't work for the Postal Service. He's one of the contractors for the Postal Service, who said that, well, it would, the post office would be better off in private hands. Without anything to qualify that. Just because that's what he's been told day in, day out. And for me, it comes to the education process. You know, a friend of mine who's a teacher, you know, very concerned that we're moving towards completely privatizing education. And as he put it, you know, the reality is it's all we're being told. We're being told public education is failing. It needs to be reformed. And reform means profitized. And that's all we hear. Because the message is in our ear constantly. The ads are on the radio. The stories are out there constantly. And when something bad happens in charter world, it's not near the front page. You know, last week, a guy pled guilty to stealing money from one of the charter schools. And you hear these stories fairly often. In fact, too often. But yet, we're still full bore. We need charter schools. In fact, the charter school people in Philadelphia, not all too happy about, you know, the state giving some money to the public schools, because, hey, they saw that as, hey, mission accomplished. We starved it enough. Now we can really profit from it. There's so much, man. There's just so much to get to. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com. That's where you get the podcast or Stitcher on the smartphone. Take the program on the go. You can always email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally and enjoy the back and forth. It just is what it is. But as I said, we need to stay up on things. We need to stay active, engaged, and in the streets, which I'm glad to see going on in Philadelphia. And I'm hoping when they come back from this last session, their little break, I'm hoping we're back here at the Capitol. Quick break, right back.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Modern-day sharecroppers on wheels will rally in Los Angeles in a Teamster effort to organize port drivers. Doug Cunningham reports.
The Teamsters, port workers, and supporters will rally in Los Angeles August 27th in the drive to organize port truck drivers. Nick Weiner is Port's campaign director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. He says the union has had some success at the ports, and drivers misclassified as independent contractors are fed up with pay and conditions and are more interested than ever in joining the Teamsters.
They're fed up. They're the modern-day sharecroppers just on wheels. Now drivers are taking notice at other companies. So what's happening in a couple weeks is a big rally in L.A., and leading the way are drivers at this company called Green Fleet. And some of their big customers are like Skechers shoes and Huffy bikes. They're coming together. They want to be treated fairly. And so we're going to have a big rally on the 27th.
Weiner says while conditions in overseas sweatshops are often horrific, much of the supply chain of imports is here on U.S. soil. So he says the Teamsters are focusing on helping workers here improve their conditions.
And there's jobs here that can't be outsourced, can't be shipped overseas, that should be good, decent jobs. So that's what we're trying to do.
In less than 2 months, individuals will be able to start shopping for health insurance on marketplaces created under the Affordable Care Act.
Wisconsin is one of the states that has chosen to forgo setting up a state-specific exchange and instead is allowing the federal government to step in and do it. The Walker administration is expected to release information regarding health insurance rates by the end of the month. MIT economist Jonathan Gruber said in a conference call on Friday that when the rates are released, it's important to also factor in tax credits intended to reduce the cost.
By my estimate, the post-tax credit price falls by, you know, by about 5 or 6% in the state. And after you count for tax credits, the price in this market falls. Now, there are some winners and some losers. And the losers are essentially the people who have benefited from existing discrimination in this market. You've got Wisconsin has a highly discriminatory non-group market where young, healthy people can get excellent rates and older, sicker people are excluded and have to go to the high-risk pool where they pay expensive rates that are subsidized by the state. So it's not surprising that you end up with some losers. Anytime you end discrimination, the group that benefits from that discrimination will be worse off. That's the idea of ending discrimination, is to benefit the people who have been discriminated against.
Nearly half of the consumers expected to buy into the marketplace will receive tax credits.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
And from what you said, I know you've gotten over me. It'll never be the way it is.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Yes, the right-to-work nonsense, the no-rights-at-work agenda back on the agenda thanks to the American Legislative Exchange Council's conference in Chicago not too long ago. In fact, Missouri Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder, he predicted that the Republicans in the Missouri State Legislature would bring back the no-rights-at-work law and put it on the ballot next year in Missouri. And not go through the legislature because we're taking it to the voters. And you know, as we've been saying here, look, all of this stuff is right. It's always there. It's always right under the surface. It's always right there for the radical extremes of the Republican Party to go after. And they are here in Pennsylvania, which is why we've asked Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale to come talk to us. Rick, thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure to be on the show, Rick.
So I look at this and, you know, as I said, you know, this no rights at work thing, this so-called euphemistically named right to work bill law being proposed right here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, they've introduced it for probably at least the last 30 or 40 years. They keep bringing it forward. And so far, the people of Pennsylvania have not been fooled. And, you know, they're always very good at the titling of things to basically take away people's rights and to put people into poverty. They always find a good euphemism for creating poverty, which is exactly what right to work does. If you look in the states that have right to work, their wages are consistently lower than wages. Non-right to work states, their accidents on the job are higher, their health care is lower, they have to work longer because they have their pensions aren't as good, they have higher infant mortality rates. All kinds of things are associated with lower wages and poverty that right to work laws tend to bring about.
You know, when I look at this, you know, it's one of those phrases that labor used to use in the past that said we should have the right to work, which means actually a right to a job. But what they're talking about is something completely different than the right to have a job, as a right to work for basically nothing is what they're talking about.
Exactly. It has nothing to do, and you tell people that, because it is I wish I had thought of the name of the group, but it is a great way to fool people. Oh, sure, everybody should have the right to work. But right now, with unemployment at 6% and 7%, not everybody certainly has the right to work. You know, you don't have a right to a job. You have to go get a job. And these guys have basically what they're trying to do is make it so that you have the right to work at the wages that they want to pay you, which tend to be lower and lower instead of having a union where you could get bargain for better wages and working conditions.
Now, at this point, I don't know that there's an appetite to pass this in Pennsylvania. Like you, it's there. There's a potential for it, but I don't know that the voters of Pennsylvania would be all that thrilled. So what I see is an incremental creeping toward it. And I understand there's a hearing coming up this week. I guess they've had another hearing on stalking. Evidently, they're trying to combine. They're trying to claim that if I talk to my coworker, that's stalking in some way.
Well,
Explain that to me.
Well, it's a little bit of a the national or the U.S. Chamber of Commerce came out with a study based on stuff from ALEC that said Pennsylvania has some preferential labor treatment in their anti-stalking, anti-harassment bill, which was passed in the 90s to protect, you know, women from being harassed and stalked, and all people, actually. It was gender neutral. From being harassed and stalked anywhere. And the business community who had we had always accused of, you know, stalking and harassing us while we were trying to organize or we were on a picket line, actually came to the labor movement and asked that we exempt parties in a labor dispute from that law. And out of that, again, this was requested by business in the 90s, out of that, the U.S. Chamber has figured somehow the labor movement has an unfair advantage, and maybe what they didn't, maybe their reading skills aren't that good down in D.C., but what they failed to notice is it says both parties in a labor, or all parties in a labor dispute. It doesn't say labor unions. It doesn't say management. It says all parties involved in a labor dispute. And historically, 89% of illegal activity, stalking and harassing of workers happens by management during organizing drives and strikes. 11% is on the worker side. So, you know, we went along with it because we thought, well, that's constitutionally protected activity. You know, if you're picketing and those kind of things, you should have the right to do that. So we supported the amendment that was proposed by a Republican, by the way. In the 90s. He was a conservative in the 90s. I guess today they'd consider him a moderate. But anyway, the bill passed, and the language is there. And so now Ron Miller is trying to say that we have some kind of unfair advantage. And again, it protects both parties in a labor dispute, not just labor.
Yeah,
it's
ridiculous. And reading through that, you know, you look at it and you go, having myself been a party to a number of organizing campaigns over the years, I've firsthand seen some of that stuff going on with the people following you around with a video camera and people, you know, trying to provoke you into doing something. I think back very vividly and remember a bunch of that stuff.
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, every time you're on a picket line, they send somebody out with a camera. It's been a long time since I've actually done an organizing drive, but, when I was on them, they routinely would follow workers into bathrooms to make sure they didn't talk to each other about the union. They would follow them to their homes. They would make sure they would spy. They'd put cars outside of workers' homes, making sure that other workers weren't coming over to talk union. Very much a harassing and stalking kind of activities by the employers and organizing drives.
So now they're going to, this hearing that they're having, are they going to look at the employer side of this? I mean, the captive meetings, you know, all, you know, forcing people to go and be browbeaten. Any of that going to come up in this hearing coming up on Thursday?
Well, it certainly will in our testimony. There was some question or not whether or not we were going to be there, and but they did invite us to come testify. Now, there are, I think, six employer folks testifying, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and oddly enough, not the State Chamber of Commerce, who actually supported the bill 20 years ago, but the U.S. Chamber and then some folks in from Philly and so I think they got about six employer-type testifiers and, of course, us. So the odds are about even.
So let me ask you, as we move down the road, come back from the summer break, What does the next legislative session look like? What are we looking at down the road as the attacks on workers and the attacks on education and all that continues? Will we see a transportation bill? Will we see more push for privatizing the wine and spirit shops and the lottery? What are you thinking?
Well, I think it's all going to come back. I think, you know, these guys seem to be more interested in making people poor than creating jobs. I mean, anytime you have a system that creates 5,000 jobs, good-paying jobs, that puts money in both into the general fund and the employees who pay their income taxes on a higher wage rate than somebody who would work in a corner liquor store making $8 an hour. So you actually benefit from both ends. You know, an asset like the lottery that generates, you know, millions and possibly billions of dollars for senior citizens. And why you would sell off those? Well, I know why they'd sell off their assets, because they want to make their contributors who can't make it in the private sector, they want to make them rich off of government entities. So that's we expect to see both that back. We expect to see the attack on pensions. And the one thing that would create jobs, a good transportation bill. The Republicans have tended not to. Not to want to put up the votes necessary to get a transportation bill, because you know it costs money sometimes to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they don't always want to do the right thing by putting people to work by spending some money, which again generates more revenues because people work and they're paying their taxes. They're contributing to the economy and the community and buying food and bread and all those kind of things. They don't seem to get basic economics. They think putting people out of work and into poverty is the way to grow the economy.
Yeah, I mean, a jobs plan would be the best thing to help alleviate poverty. And I'd like to get your thoughts on Republican Policy Committee Chairman Dave Reed's Empowering Opportunities Poverty Initiative, because as you know, you may know they're going around the state because Chairman Reed wants to see the face of poverty. Probably can't find it in his district.
Actually, you can. And I would tell Dave to go to some of the poorer rural areas. They seem to have this idea that poverty only exists in cities, whereas there's a huge amount of poverty in rural Pennsylvania. And all Dave Reed has to do is drive down a couple of the back roads in Indiana County in order to find the grinding poverty that is debilitating to people and keeps them from getting up and on their own and into the middle class. Dave has no further to look than his own backyard. But, of course, these guys tend to think of – they've never had it tough, right? And they tend to think of poverty as something that's urban rather than rural, where most of the welfare is and, you know, most of the food stamps are in rural America, not urban America.
So what would be the – you know, if – we had Policy Chairman Reed's ear, what would be the policy that would help alleviate poverty? Because, look, I don't think any of us are in favor of having high levels of poverty. I think we all want to find a solution. Personally, I think a jobs plan would be a good idea. You know, the kind of thing that Governor Corbett said that he was going to pursue as governor back in 2010, that really hasn't happened. But what would we do if we had the ability to get to Chairman Reed's ear?
Well, you know, and this goes back to look, we could do a lot of programs to help people, and we should, and we do. But the real way to get people out of poverty is to level the playing field and let them organize unions. They will get themselves out of poverty if they're in an organized workplace when they can sit across the table with that employer, look at the books, see what the employer makes, make sure that the company's making good jobs, and then ask for a portion of the productivity that they deliver to that employer so that he can make 200 or 420 times what they make, and they only want a 20-cent an hour raise or a nickel an hour raise. That's the way you lift people out of poverty. You give them the ability to unionize. It's that old saying, give a man a fish, he feeds himself a day. Give him a union, he'll feed himself for a lifetime.
There you go. And to highlight that point, in looking at the National Compensation Survey put out by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, they pointed out in 1992 the average worker in this country had 10 sick days in their first year, down to 8 today. Somebody with 20 years service back in 1992 had 17 sick days compared to 10 today. And you go back and you go, well, why is that? How is that possible? Well, in 1992, union density was 15.2% in this country. It's down to 11.3 right now. Workers had a stronger bargaining position back then and were able to get some better things, like better vacation as well.
Absolutely. Strong unions will lead to strong rights and a strong middle class. That's what's happened historically in this country. And if you want to repeat the building of the middle class, let people organize. They'll take care of their own business.
Yep. Last question I've got for you. What's the main issue coming up in the fall that we should be worried about?
Well, I think we're hearing different things. Some folks tell us pensions. Some folks tell us wine and spirits. Certainly one of those two. We'll see an attack on. And again, this, you know, I know there are a lot of folks out there in the private sector who think that, you know, public employees have it good. But for your listeners, I'd just like to remind them that, you know, the average pension for public employees is anywhere from $20,000 to $24,000 a year. Some of them don't have didn't pay into Social Security. They paid into their pension. Some of them pay into both, which is probably 12 to 13% of their salary every paycheck every year, and that's money that they put in and the state's invested it for them. And we need strong pensions for everybody.
Yep.
We shouldn't be saying, you have this, I don't, so you shouldn't have it. That person should be saying, I need something like that. I need a strong pension. Because we want people to retire. We want them to retire and open up the jobs that they had so that our kids can move into positions and get jobs because people retired. And that's what we need.
I'm right there with you. Rick, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate you taking time for us.
Absolutely, Rick. Good to be on the show.
Rick Bloomingdale, president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
We got to get older right. We got to do it today. No more madness than food. No more disarray.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The voters, damn them, have got to be subverted. You won't find that autocratic principle taught in any civics class, but it's one that America's corporate powers openly embrace when local democracy offends them. Just ask the voters of Orlando, Florida, who recently felt the sting of such arrogance. A grassroots coalition called Organize Now had collected 50,000 signatures last year to put an earned sick time referendum on their county's November ballot. It was to be a citizens' vote on whether employers should let workers earn a few days each year of paid leave to be used if they fall ill or must care for a sick family member. Whoa, shouted the bosses of Disney World, Olive Garden, Red Lobster, and other super wealthy low-wage corporations in Orlando that provide minimal or no benefits. We can't allow that. So they leaned on the county commissioners to knock the referendum off the ballot. However, the scrappy Organize Now bunch took them to court and won. The people's victory was too late for last year's election, though, so the court ordered that the referendum be put on the 2014 ballot. So, all set, right? Not so fast, shouted the corporate powers as they scuttled off to Tallahassee, demanding that the GOP governor and state legislative leaders deliver a, quote, kill shot to those pesky voters back in Orlando. Sure enough, the obsequious corporate-hugging politicos obliged in June by enacting a brutish, democracy-smashing law called state preemption. It autocratically usurps the right of local governments and local voters to enact paid sick leave benefits. This is Jim Hightower saying, still, it's not over, for the corporate subversion of the people is not real popular, and maybe not even legal. Organize Now is pushing back and pushing ahead. Keep up with them at www.orgnow.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. It's Manufacturing Monday.
Hello, Detroit. All the workers, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just to send it on down the line.
1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. They're saying that manufacturing is ticking up here in the U.S. As conditions get worse, as wages go down, as benefits go away, as fuel costs go up, maybe we'll bring some of that stuff back. And I've often heard it said that that we'll get manufacturing back when we're Bangladesh. And you look at how did we get here? And I've always said that it was the Reagan years. It was that movement that he was the poster child of, that whole deregulation, that whole push towards, we need to let the businesses go, unleash the businesses. Yeah, we unleashed them, all right. Unleashed them to other countries where they could exploit there. Because, of course, we're regulating everybody. We're regulating the country out of existence with too much regulation. And those unions who want money, they want to share in what? They want to share the profits? No. It's an interesting story written by Alan Pike, who points out that the research by economists Alvaretto, Atkinson, Pinketty, and Sayers, they started with the simple question, why does inequality vary so widely among wealthy countries with broadly similar economic systems? Why are we in the UK, similar countries, why do we have much greater income inequality? Because they pursued the same basic ideas of tax cuts for the very well-to-do. But they don't have the massive top 1% that we do. They don't have that huge weight. Granted, they're up there, but nowhere in our area. And they've come to the realization that it was deregulation. It was this whole push to deregulate the financial industry in particular. The article points out that rich-friendly tax changes didn't happen in a vacuum. They said that it was accompanied by deregulation, creating a perfect storm for Wall Street. As the top 1% of Americans got richer, they also got much more likely to work in finance. He writes, financial professionals made up almost twice as much of the top 1% of the income distribution in 2005 as they did in 1979, by far the largest jump in any profession in those terms. And, as I've been saying for the longest time, for me, you want to turn this country back around, bring me back a Teddy Roosevelt-type character. Bring me a trust buster, someone to break up the monopoly that's going on, someone to bring back a rational, sane tax code that's going to say, we want people to be entrepreneurial, we want them to invest, we want them to do well, but there's only so much gluttony we're going to allow. And, as Krugman calls it, the Great Compression, we need another Great Compression, like you saw after World War II. The billionaire class has gotten too large, too big, too powerful, whatever way you want to put it. They have too much control. And over the weekend, I was talking to a teacher friend who was saying, maybe the assault on education will stop because, some people are waking up. And I'm going, no. The moneyed interests want it. The moneyed interests, they most certainly want the control of education. And it's not even really the money so much as it's the control of thought. I'm over the weekend, I happened to I had the opportunity to talk to a couple of people who drive a truck for a living. And all of the radio that they listen to is right-wing dribble. So when you have conversations with them, they spew what they hear all day long, which are basically just right-wing talking points because they don't hear anything else. There's no other rational thought that goes into their heads other than the drivel that they're hearing coming out of the speakers. So when you talk to them and you say, well, okay, you know, privatization of education, good thing, that's what you're saying, okay. Here's why it's not. And then you tick through, you know, the profit motive, first and foremost, should we be taking money out of classrooms to give to profiteers that should be going to educating children? And then they go, wait, no, I don't think so. We should be using that money for books and computers and schools and all. You're right there. Should we take away local control? I mean, should we take the school boards away and replace them with boards of directors like we have with our corporations? And to a man, they all say, well, no, we want to have a say what's going on in our classrooms and what our kids are learning. Should schools have to take all kids? And to a man, because, you know, most, I've got to be honest, most truck drivers are not your rocket scientists. They didn't do really well in school. Most of the ones that I've met, they did well, but most really not. They said, well, no, I needed to go to school. Well, would I have made it? And that's a question that I ask quite often. You know, when we start cutting out who can and who can't go to school, who gets cut out? But I go back to, you know, it's what we hear all day. It's the message that's being pumped into our ears ad nauseum. The food stamp thing to me is huge. You know, this video that Fox News did last week with the Spicoli lookalike. And when we come back from after the next break, we're going to talk with Craig Harrington. I'm going to ask him if he's seen the video and what his thoughts are, because I got to be honest, when I look at this video, it's a setup to me. There's just no way that I believe that that's just the guy walking around. That's what he does every day. Sorry, on $150 or $180 a month or whatever food stamps is now, you're not buying sushi and lobster very often. And if that's your source of survival, sorry, not buying it. I think this is a stunt. I think something was set up. I think there's a whole bunch to this story that we'll hear down the road. But the sad thing is the damage will have already been done. And I guess my problem is, you know, I remember the run up to the first Iraq war. And I don't know how many other people may remember this, but there was a little girl, a Kuwaiti girl, who testified in front of Congress that she was a candy striper in a Kuwaiti hospital and that the Iraqi soldiers came in and threw babies out of incubators. And I think you can Google that. Just Google babies out of incubators, and it'll come up with this girl's name who happened to be the daughter of the ambassador in the U.S. to from Kuwait to the U.S. Turns out she had not been in Kuwait at the time. And it was all just a PR stunt to get people all worked up. They never found Amnesty International looked into it. Initially, they said, oh, yeah. And then, oops, well, we realized it was a PR stunt. I think that's what this is. But after the fact, you find this out years later when the damage is already done. And the damage is going to be they want to destroy food stamps. They want to literally take food out of the mouths of children. That's what has me just infuriated. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, teaching America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Modern-day sharecroppers on wheels will rally in Los Angeles in a Teamster effort to organize port drivers. Doug Cunningham reports.
The Teamsters, port workers, and supporters will rally in Los Angeles August 27th in the drive to organize port truck drivers. Nick Weiner is Port's campaign director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. He says the union has had some success at the ports, and drivers misclassified as independent contractors are fed up with pay and conditions and are more interested than ever in joining the Teamsters.
They're fed up. They're the modern-day sharecroppers just on wheels. Now drivers are taking notice at other companies. So what's happening in a couple weeks is a big rally in L.A., and leading the way are drivers at this company called Greenfleet. And some of their big customers are like Skechers Shoes and Huffy Bikes. They're coming together. They want to be treated fairly. And so we're going to have a big rally on the 27th.
Weiner says while conditions in overseas sweatshops are often horrific, much of the supply chain of imports is here on U.S. soil. So he says the Teamsters are focusing on helping workers here improve their conditions.
And there's jobs here that can't be outsourced, that can't be shipped overseas, that should be good, decent jobs. So that's what we're trying to do.
In less than 2 months, individuals will be able to start shopping for health insurance on marketplaces created under the Affordable Care Act. Wisconsin is one of the states that has chosen to forego setting up a state-specific exchange and instead is allowing the federal government to step in and do it. The Walker administration is expected to release information regarding health insurance rates by the end of the month. MIT economist Jonathan Gruber said in a conference call on Friday that when the rates are released, it's important to also factor in tax credits intended to reduce the cost.
By my estimate, the post-tax credit price falls by about 5 or 6% in the state. And after you count for tax credits, the price in this market falls. Now, there are some winners and some losers. And the losers are essentially the people who have benefited from existing discrimination in this market. You've got Wisconsin has a highly discriminatory non-group market where young, healthy people can get excellent rates and older, sicker people are excluded and have to go to the high-risk pool where they pay expensive rates that are subsidized by the state. So it's not surprising that you end up with some losers. Anytime you end discrimination, the group that benefits from that discrimination will be worse off. That's the idea of ending discrimination, is to benefit the people who have been discriminated against.
Nearly half of the consumers expected to buy into the marketplace will receive tax credits.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
One of the objectives we have over the next couple months is to help folks understand some of the circumstances that lead folks to a life of poverty. It could just be one bad decision or one unfortunate circumstance that spirals to a life of poverty. And we hope to examine what those decisions are, what barriers are keeping folks in poverty, and helping to eliminate some of those barriers in the future for individuals and families across the state.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So at the end of the month, August 31st, it will be 49 years since the Food Stamp Act was signed into law. And for 49 years, we've been hearing people complaining that there are people who are stealing from the system, waste, fraud, and abuse. We've been hearing, in fact, the latest one, the Spicoli of food stamps, just has me scratching my head going, this got to be a setup. There's just no way that kid exists. Anyway, here to help us work through this, the assault on food stamps, is Craig Harrington. He's the economic researcher over at Media Matters for America. Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So Spicoli's getting food stamps, Craig. We need to get rid of the whole system.
Yeah, that was the narrative that was pushed on the August 9th edition of Special Report with Brett Baer on the Fox News channel. They had this hour-long special where they sort of highlighted this guy named Jason Greenslade, who's one of our researchers here on staff, said that he was a parody of an actual human being. He's someone who's blatantly defrauding and abusing the food stamp system for his own benefit by his own admission. And Fox was just putting him out there over and over again, they use the term that he is the new face of food stamps and he's the poster child for food stamps. And it was really a very disingenuous discussion of something that's very important that helps over 47 million Americans with their nutrition assistance. And to put up this guy, this surfer from Southern California, it was just a caricature of the whole situation.
Yeah, it's kind of like the local media did here in Harrisburg back about a year and a half ago when the Republicans were destroying unemployment compensation here in the state. They got a guy who was in jail who said that he was collecting unemployment while in jail, which you can't do, which he was admitting to fraud. And, you know, actually he was admitting that both him and his girlfriend were defrauding the unemployment compensation system. But this was the face of unemployment in their view. And I see the exact same thing here. You got a guy who I've got to think that there's an ulterior motive here, because I watched that thing a couple of times. Nobody acts like that, and nobody is going to play to the camera like that without there being a back end, without there being something that down the road we're going to find out about.
You're certainly not the first person who's voiced that opinion. I was talking with another radio show. Unfortunately, I was unfaithful, and I was talking with Chuck Showalter on the Union Edge show, and he brought up a question that a lot of people have brought up is this Jason Greenslate guy even is he a real person? We know he's a real person. You know, he has an online presence, but is this really his lifestyle? Was there some sort of incentive for him, excuse me, to pretend or to embellish or exaggerate that lifestyle for the Fox News producers? What we know is that the New York City Coalition Against Hunger has sat down on several occasions with Fox News producers for lengthy interviews. And they say over and over again that those interviews are selectively edited and taken out of context to portray food stamps and SNAP beneficiaries in the most negative light possible. And so it's possible that what we see in New York City is the same in Southern California.
Yeah, I have no doubt that it was selectively edited. But you don't go and say, I'm having welfare lobster. I mean, it's just not something you say without there being an ulterior motive. I know they claimed he wanted to be a musician.
Yeah.
To me, it just seemed, it reeked of, I'm going to get my 15 minutes.
At the very least, Mr. Greenslate and Fox News have made one overworked auditor at the United States Department of Agriculture. They've made their job a little bit easier for one or two days, because when they look up that fraud and abuse claim, it'll probably be cut and dry for them.
So now does he go? Do we push for him to go to jail? Because I got to be honest, I saw it. I was angry.
Well, I don't know what you do with Mr. Greenslate in particular, but I do know how the right wing media has been building off of this food stamp special that they had last week. Actually, just this morning, Fox News was running with new information. The United States Department of Agriculture releases 3-year data set on food stamps. And one of the things that we saw this morning is that the rate of fraud and abuse increased marginally from the 2006 to 2008 period, which was 1%, and the 2009 through 2011 period is 1.3%. And, of course, if you look at that in terms of the historical averages, 1% and 1.3% are still far below historical averages for fraud and abuse. But, of course, in the right-wing media, particularly on Fox News, they didn't say that we've gone from 99% effective eligibility to 98.7% effective eligibility. What they said is that fraud increased 30% in an $80 billion program that has 48 million participants. And so there's always some way to slant the evidence in their favor, which is always pushing this narrative that we have to cut benefits programs and cut food stamps in particular.
You know, I look at this, and I got to be honest, I've never been a fan of food stamps, and I've never been a fan of programs that are viewed as handouts. I agree with A. Philip Randolph when they came out with this in the 60s. Instead of having food stamps, he wanted a jobs program, and I think the way forward for me anyway is we need strong jobs legislation. I truly believe there's a therapeutic quality to work. I believe that, making your way in the world is good for self-esteem. And you get away from all of this nonsense that the right wing is pushing, that the face of food stamps is Spicoli or some African-American woman driving around in a Cadillac with diamond rings. I just think at some point, We've got to be changing how things are done just as a matter of course.
There's actually a pretty strong economic argument for what you're putting forward, which is to, you know, change the legislative portfolio from being something that is handing out a benefit to people who are taxpayers and who are temporarily taking this assistance, getting away from a handout benefit to a more job-centered and productivity-centered focus of legislation. The problem is that all of the social welfare programs that the United States has in place, including food stamps, including unemployment insurance and other benefits programs that come out of state, federal, and local governments, all of them have an economic stimulative effect.
Right.
And in lieu of an actual jobs program that can pass the House of Representatives where they obstruct 100% of all Democratic-led legislation, 100% of legislation is obstructed in some way, the only thing we have is the food stamp program, the SNAP program, the unemployment insurance program, because the Republicans in the House refuse to allow a jobs program to go forward, and a lot of that has to do with their allies in the right-wing media who continue to push this narrative that the government can't do anything well and that the only way to stimulate growth is to just reduce the government and
more tax
go forward
for the wealthy.
Go forward with this sort of dystopian libertarian future.
You know, my problem with my argument, though, and I got to be honest, you know, I do believe government should be the employer of last resort, and we should be pushing for higher wages. My problem is that a large number of the faces of people who are recipients of food stamps, they're working people. We've allowed in this country a business model that thrives on food stamps and on Medicaid, the business model of the low-wage employment sector is, well, you know what, we're going to pay you substandard wages that we know you can't live on. In fact, I look at the website, I don't know if you saw it, McDonald's and Visa combined to do a kind of a lecture budget page for their employees. They admitted in their little budget that there's no way in hell you're going to survive on a 40-hour work week at McDonald's. And they came up with a whole second full-time income. Not sure where those hours came from, but it takes two full-time jobs working at McDonald's to make even as minimal a living as they were able to eke out in their budget.
Yeah, I think the typical McDonald's worker from that sample budget that McDonald's put out, they're working 40 hours a week and making $17,000 annually and then making an additional $12,000 on the side through some other odd job that would have to be something like 25 to 30 hours a week of work. But you've hit the nail right on the head with the real problem is that wages aren't increasing with the cost of living. Just a couple of hours ago, I actually published an article on MediaMatters.org that's titled Right-Wing Media Have No Clue How Anti-Poverty Programs Work. And the gist of the article is that the right-wing media keep pushing this myth that anti-poverty programs like food stamps and like what they were calling over and over again derisively welfare, these welfare programs are created as a safety net against recessions and against downturns.
Yes.
But they think that they actually cause the recessions and cause the downturns. They think that because you can live so lavishly on government benefits, there's no impetus to go out and find real work. What that ignores, first of all, is that you're not living well on government benefits. You're living just at the survival level. But additionally, it ignores the fact that many of these people are working and they still need government benefits. You're not going to encourage someone to go out onto the job market by cutting their benefits if they're already on the job market and they're using benefits. If you cut those benefits for them and they're not replacing it with an increase in income, then you're just going to hurt that person. And that's what we saw with welfare reform in the 1990s, and that's what the right-wing media and the conservatives would like to see us do again.
You know, I go back to the 90s, and I'm not a huge Bill Clinton fan, never have been. We could argue for days about it, but to me, the welfare reform bill of 96, well, it was truly a huge mistake in my view. Because I remember before they passed that, the McDonald's up the street from my house was paying $10 an hour to their workers. Within 6 months after the passage, it was back down to minimum wage.
Yeah. And
because you pushed all of these people into the labor pool without any way for them to take care of their kids. I mean, there was so many so many negative outcomes that came out of this, and you dropped out the bottom of the labor pool, which is exactly what it was meant to do.
And the 1996 welfare reform bill that Bill Clinton signed into law is particularly important because that's exactly the impetus for today's recent attacks on food stamps and on welfare. Fox News began the morning attacking SNAP, and they ended the day with a comprehensive segment where they brought on Michael Tanner of the Cato Institute. And Tanner, in 1995, released a paper from Cato that was seminal in pushing this impetus for welfare reform. And what he's essentially done this year is taken that paper that he wrote and published in 1995 that was widely debunked by actual economists, and he's taken that and just updated the numbers and re-released it here in 2013. This isn't a quarterly release. It's not annual or decadal or biannual. This is something that he wrote 18 years ago that he just updated the numbers for and reintroduced. And
just
the reason he did it
shelf.
20 years ago, 18 years ago, he released this paper, and it terrified the Democrats, and it pushed them to do welfare reform. And now he has a more cohesive right-wing media industry that he can work with. So when he reintroduces this, he's hoping to get into the coattails of the debt ceiling and of the government shutdown debate that we're going to see in September and October. And probably the Republicans and the right-wing media certainly are going to be pushing this welfare reform proposal as if 1996 was a success.
You know, and I look at this, and you know, to me the welfare that infuriates me is I look at our governor gave $6 million to a company to move across the river from New Jersey into Pennsylvania of a $7 million project. I look at the $1.7 billion that they've given in tax handouts to Royal Dutch Shell to build a cracker plant they were going to build here anyway. I look at all of this money, the Delaware loophole, the drilling, all of the stuff that's going on. To me, that's the welfare that I'm concerned about. All of these handouts that we've given to the very well-to-do, the billionaire class that we've created through lost opportunities, not just for you and me, but for my kids, that's the welfare that I'm focused on. But the sad reality, Craig, is I don't think the average everyday person sees the Koch brothers. I don't think they see the billionaire class and the lavish lifestyles that they lead. They see that guy and the family who's struggling with the EBT card in front of them, and that's what they see, and that's where they're focused on.
It's true. You know, the Walton family, for example, of Walmart fame, they have as much collective wealth as 40% of the working population of the United States. Those six heirs to Sam Walton's Walmart legacy have as much wealth as 40% of the population of the United States. And every single one of their stores is subsidized in some way through corporate welfare. They receive tax incentives and write-offs to keep their wages low, and they're able to keep low wages because their employees survive off of taxpayer benefits. That is the welfare that's really costing the economy, you know. Helping a Walmart worker make ends meet through SNAP and WIC, that's not breaking the back of the American economy. But having a gigantic multi-billion-dollar company, the wealthiest company in the world or among the wealthiest companies in the world, allowing it to pay its workers starvation wages,
yep.
So that CEOs can take home bigger paychecks, that's the real welfare problem.
And for me, it all comes back down to allowing those workers to organize to where they can join and form unions and they can bargain for a bit of that well, 40%. Where did that wealth come from that the six Walmart heirs now control 40%, more than 40, the bottom 40%? Where did that wealth come from?
It wasn't
magic. It came from those 40%.
Yeah. They didn't create it themselves. They drew it from the bottom.
Yep.
And the big issue with worker organization is a lot of workers are turned off by the idea of unionization. And it's understandable to have some concerns with it. But the fact is, when you have higher participation in worker unions across the economy, you see wages go up. You don't have to be a part of a union to see a benefit from someone else in your sector being part of a union.
See, I got to tell you, Craig, you know, as someone who grew up in poverty, someone who grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, had it not been for my union membership and the contract that came with it, with the good wages and the benefits, I wouldn't be in the middle class. I wouldn't live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers, and my kids wouldn't have the opportunities that they're going to have. And the message that working people in this country need to hear and need to hear often is that, you know what, being able to survive on what you work for That's the way we move this country forward. That's how we end poverty. That's how we build communities, and that's how we move this country back to that American dream that I was raised to believe in.
I think that's absolutely true. One of the problems that we've seen recently is that we've fallen into a state where the economy in general is built toward inequality. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich is actually involved in a documentary called Inequality for All, which discusses this sort of cyclical decline really since 1979, 1980, where we've seen the economy become more and more unequal and more stratified all across all economic sectors, all races, all ethnicities, and really all different wage hierarchies. The difference between a one percenter today and a one percenter in 1979 is stark. It's almost as different as someone who was in the 1% in 79 would be upper middle class by the same standards today. What we've seen is just a gigantic stratification of wealth in what is the wealthiest country in the world, and a lot of it has to do with a lack of union organization. A lot of it has to do with a stagnation of wages, and a lot of it has to do with something you just talked about before the break, which is outsourcing of jobs and offshoring of wealth to foreign production.
It's the whole neoliberal agenda. I mean, that's in a nutshell, it's all the free trade, it's all the deregulation, it's all of that stuff, all wrapped up into one ball.
Yeah, and the argument that you get from people who are pro-deregulation and pro-free trade, who are in favor of unfettered markets and complete deregulation, is that, you know, the reason that we've seen these neoliberal economic systems fail is that we just haven't embraced it enough yet.
Yep.
It's the same argument you hear from the right-wing media about tax cuts. You know, if you just cut taxes a little more, then you'll see the economic growth that we were promising.
Yeah, I seem to remember that, you know, in some of the readings I did as a kid about bloodletting. The reason that you didn't die is we didn't let the blood come out enough.
It's not a bad analogy.
Amazing stuff. But I got to be honest with you, Craig. I see this attack going on, and there are so few voices out there standing up for people who really, truly do need. We don't see the Fox News. We don't see anybody out there going to families who they made it this week. Their kids got something to eat this week because that benefit was there. And I'm telling you, when I was a kid, had it not been for food stamps, as much as it degraded me to have to use them when I was a kid, we wouldn't have gotten to the end of the month. We wouldn't have gotten, there wouldn't have been food on our table because, you know, the 70s were not a particularly good time for a single mother. And times were tough, especially where we lived, not even on the bus line. So for me to turn around and say that we need to take food out of the mouths of children would be A, hypocritical, and B, just flat wrong.
And it's entirely true. What we had, our senior fellow here at Media Matters, Eric Bollert, was on MSNBC earlier today. And what he was talking about is the right-wing media with a relentless demonization of poor people. One of the things we talked about here on the research floor today is, you know, in the dog days of August when the news cycle is winding down, one of the things you can always count on is right-wing attacks on poor people. It's just too easy to attack the disenfranchised and the less fortunate because they don't have a voice. They don't have a media angle. They don't have a news channel that's dedicated to 24-hour propaganda for the disenfranchised. There's a reason that they don't have a voice, and it's that everyone looks the other way and gets distracted by these other things.
Well, like any bully, it's easy to pick on the weak and the defenseless.
Yeah, you wouldn't pick on someone your own size. That's the whole point.
And I look at, you know, the fake news people, and they're all bullies.
It's true. And one of the things you see, you know, Stuart Varney, who's a Fox business analyst and one of the hosts of their morning shows, he fessed up a couple of weeks ago and said, yes, he is being mean to poor people, but he's doing it for their own benefit.
Yeah, I've heard that
because,
one.
Because, you know, what they lack isn't that they lack material wealth. They lack what he called a richness of spirit, and they needed to be sort of scared straight in the way that you would take a delinquent teenager to a prison to meet inmates. And it's just, it's crude and it's rude, and it's also a brutal way of approaching economic policy, particularly from a public policy standpoint. When you actually have a voice in the media, you should be using it for the best good,
yeah,
not just for your own good.
So the question I have with that then is that really what he believes, or is that what they're selling? Because, well, it plays to that Horatio Alger vision of ourselves that we can, you know, we can whittle bootstraps and pull ourselves up by them.
It's tough to see, tough to say sometimes. I think there's, among the right-wing media, particularly among the most outspoken members of, you know, Fox News, for example, there's a mixture of people who are capitalizing for their own benefit and people who are also mixing in their own sort of misled ideology. If, for example, you think that expanding welfare causes recessions, well, you have just a distinctly different way of dealing with reality. One of the things that we see from the really rabid members of the right-wing media is that they deal with reality in a way that's just totally different from the objective. Everything comes with this slant, which is always this blatant and naked self-interest in the end. Right. And there's really no way around that.
That comes down to the moneyed interests who are funding all this stuff. It just is what it is. But, Craig, I always appreciate talking with you. It's always interesting and thoughtful. I appreciate the time, man.
Thanks for having me on again.
Our good friend Craig Harrington, economic researcher over at Media Matters for America. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Craig's name. It'll take you right there. You know, but I think about this, and I go back, and, you know, I remember as a kid, and this is one of those things that makes you go, I could be that right-winger who, you know, said, I did it all by myself. I came from poverty, and now I live in a solidly middle-class neighborhood. See how wonderful I am. The reality is that's not true. All along the way, there was tons of public investment, tons of public interest, and a lot of really good people that I've met along my lifespan that have reached a hand to help. You know, I go back to when I was a kid. Had it not been for, and I don't even know if it was Medicaid or whatever it was called, had it not been for health care from the state of Ohio, I probably would have died. Had a major asthma attack, found me unconscious, laying on someone's front porch while I was delivering newspapers. Was in the hospital like 2.5 weeks. My hatred of needles. They kept taking blood out of the artery. Crazy woman snapped one off in my arm. But that's a whole other story. You know, had it not been for that, you know, I probably wouldn't be here. Had it not been for the food that helped, the food stamps, as much as I hated using the things. And I could tell stories of that just infuriate me, we probably wouldn't have made it. And I look at this, and you go back to right-wing world, and the view that, well, if you feed those people, they'll reproduce, which is nonsense, absolute nonsense. But I guess if you're told something long enough, I guess you could buy it. And I guess if I would allow myself to think in the vein that, you know what, I pulled myself up. So I pulled myself out of poverty. If I could believe that, maybe I could be a conservative. Maybe I could be a radical right-winger. What do you think? We live in sad times, folks, when we're actually talking about taking food out of the mouths of children. What the hell is wrong with us? And you've got an entire cable news network pushing that. Just nuts. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Modern-day sharecroppers on wheels will rally in Los Angeles in a Teamster effort to organize port drivers. Doug Cunningham reports.
The Teamsters, port workers, and supporters will rally in Los Angeles August 27th in the drive to organize port truck drivers. Nick Weiner is Port's campaign director with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. He says the union has had some success at the ports, and drivers misclassified as independent contractors are fed up with pay and conditions and are more interested than ever in joining the Teamsters.
They're fed up. They're the modern-day sharecroppers just on wheels. Now drivers are taking notice at other companies. So what's happening in a couple weeks is a big rally in L.A. and leading the way are drivers at this company called Green Fleet. And some of their big customers are like Skechers Shoes and Huffy Bikes. They're coming together. They want to be treated fairly. And so we're going to have a big rally on the 27th.
Wiener says while conditions in overseas sweatshops are often horrific, much of the supply chain of imports is here on U.S. soil. So he says the Teamsters are focusing on helping workers here improve their conditions.
And there's jobs here that can't be outsourced, that can't be shipped overseas, that should be good, decent jobs. So that's what we're trying to do.
In less than 2 months, individuals will be able to start shopping for health insurance on marketplaces created under the Affordable Care Act. Wisconsin is one of the states that has chosen to forego setting up a state-specific exchange and instead is allowing the federal government to step in and do it. The Walker administration is expected to release information regarding health insurance rates by the end of the month. MIT economist Jonathan Gruber said in a conference call on Friday that when the rates are released, it's important to also factor in tax credits intended to reduce the cost.
By my estimate, the post-tax credit price falls by, by about 5 or 6% in the state. And after you account for tax credits, the price in this market falls. Now, there are some winners and some losers. And the losers are essentially the people who have benefited from existing discrimination in this market. You've got Wisconsin has a highly discriminatory non-group market where young, healthy people can get excellent rates, and older, sicker people are excluded and have to go to the high-risk pool where they pay expensive rates that are subsidized by the state. So it's not surprising that you end up with some losers. Anytime you end discrimination, the group that benefits from that discrimination will be worse off. That's the idea of ending discrimination, is to benefit the people who have been discriminated against.
Nearly half of the consumers expected to buy into the marketplace will receive tax credits.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So as we've been talking about for the past several weeks, there's organizing going on around the country. The right wing will have you believe that, the unions are dead and dying and forget about them, that they're the old, that's the past. But we're actually seeing fast food workers, we're actually seeing retail workers, we're seeing a lot of organizing, and farm workers organizing and saying, you know what, we'd like to be able to support ourselves and our family. Thank you very much. And, what I keep saying is, with this attack on food stamps, working people who work in the fast food, the retail, and the low-wage economy should be saying, you know what, I work 40 hours a week. I shouldn't have to ask for help from the government for, for food stamps or for heating assistance or for Medicaid. I work 40 hours a week. I should be able to make it on my own. I should be able to make it because my wages should be able to support that. Just a thought. So when I saw this story written by David Bacon, who's a freelance writer and a photojournalist, that farm workers were striking against the guest worker threat, I go, well, I got to find out what that's all about. David, thanks for taking time for us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Rick.
I see you've written this piece over at Al Jazeera America. What's the guest worker threat?
Well, the guest worker threat is what's called the H-2A program. These are workers, Rick, who pick blueberries and strawberries up in Washington State for one of the largest berry growers in the state. And back in July, they began organizing themselves in order to get their piece rate up because they weren't making enough money to live on. These are workers who, most of whom live in California, and then who go up to Washington State for a few months every year to pick the berries, and then they go back to California. And so they have to make enough money during the summer picking season to be able to sustain themselves during the winter.
Yeah, they're basically, they follow the growing, sure.
Right. So it's like construction. Think about construction workers who kind of have to do the same sort of thing. So they, when they went to work, they discovered that they weren't making enough money to be able to do that. And also, they were living in a labor camp where the conditions were really bad. And I went up there and I saw what the, what the labor camp looked like. It was pretty miserable. People were, they were sleeping on mattresses that the company had given them that were so old that some of them were wrapped in plastic sheets in order to keep the insides from spilling out. So people were angry about that. They were angry because the supervisors were calling them burros, which just basically means donkeys, you know, that people were felt like they were being insulted because of their ethnicity. And these are also, they're Mexican immigrants, but they're specifically people who are native indigenous people in Mexico who speak languages that were old before Columbus ever got here. So they organized themselves, and they went out on a strike twice in July. And when they went out on strike, they discovered that the company had made an application with the federal government to bring in what are called H-2A guest workers. In other words, the company was, through a labor contractor, going to Mexico, hiring workers in Mexico, bringing them to the United States, in a system in which those workers would not be able to stay. They would just be able to work for this one company for as long as the harvest lasted, and then they would have to return to Mexico. The company would dictate the wages. The company would put them in a similar labor camp. And so the workers went on strike. First of all, they were felt pretty threatened by the fact that they felt that they were going to be replaced.
Right.
In other words, that next season maybe they wouldn't need these workers at all. They would just have guest workers. And also, the company told them that what we are going to pay these guest workers we're bringing up from Mexico, that's what we're going to pay you. We're not going to pay you any more than what we pay them. So this kind of contract labor program for workers from Mexico, in essence, it was establishing the wage rate for all of the workers at this company, including those people who have been working years and years and years picking this company's berries.
My first question on this is when I hear you say that is why should people like me care about this? These are farm workers. These are people from Mexico. Most Americans don't really seem to have much care for them. Please don't take that as my thought. But you know why? My question is why should we care about this instance?
Well, because first of all, that's who puts our food on the table. So what happens to these workers has a direct impact on all of us because anytime we sit down and we eat a bowl of berries, or in this case, Häagen-Dazs ice cream, you know, the berries that go into Häagen-Dazs ice cream are the berries that are picked by these workers. So, you know, they are an indispensable part of the food chain here, and we all depend on their labor in order to be able to eat. That's one reason. But another reason is because the system that the company has started to use here has been built into the immigration law that's been proposed and passed by the Senate and Congress.
And could happen to any one of us at any time.
Yes, and the system that they're using here, the system of guest workers, is going to get much bigger, and it's not just going to affect people who work in the fields. It's going to affect people who work in hotels or in restaurants or in construction or in meatpacking. All of those are industries in which the use of guest workers is likely to expand quite a bit under these new immigration reform proposals. And so when you see how this program really put a lid on the wages that these workers could demand from the employer and sort of undermine their ability to strike and to get better wages, you can see what's going to happen to a lot of other workers across the board.
Yeah, and that's what grabbed my attention in this. You know, as you're looking at, you know, it's something that employers have always done, using outside labor to break strikes. But now we're talking about using a guest worker program to bring people from other countries to be able to break strikes. That, to me, is a recipe for disaster. Now, look, I'm not against people immigrating to this country who want to become Americans and who want to work here. I'm not, and I don't know what your position is, but I am not in favor of a guest worker program, or a temporary thing where people come back and forth. I don't think that's good for the country. I think if you want to come here and be an American citizen and you want to contribute to the country, I'm all in favor of it. Worker thing, not at all.
That's right, and that's actually what the workers who went on strike with, they are immigrants. They are people from Mexico. One of the big ironies is that the company is going to recruit these guest workers from the same places that the workers who are already here have been coming from. The difference is in the status that people have. These guest workers are kind of like indentured servants. In other words, they have very little freedom of choice, very little freedom of movement. They have to work for the company that brought them here. They have to work for the conditions that the company established. You know, effectively speaking, they really can't organize and go on strike. You know, there have been some situations. I think all workers, you know, all workers will resist if given the opportunity. But with guest workers, the restrictions that are put on these workers make it really, really, really difficult for them to do it. And so what's really happening here is that the grower prefers one group of immigrants over another. And the reason is because these guest worker programs give the grower a way to keep wages down, to pit workers against each other, to make workers feel like danger of being replaced, basically making them feel very threatened so that they won't go on strike and won't ask for anything better. And that's the problem with these programs. It's not that we're against immigration. In fact, as I said, these strikers themselves are immigrants. The question is really, are people free to organize? Are people free to join a union? Are people free to demand better wages and better conditions? Or are we going to have programs that essentially force workers into this situation where they have very little choice?
How big is the H-2A visa program? I mean, you know, here in Pennsylvania, we the J-1 visa program that had been abused here at Hershey and at the McDonald's, we see, you know, students coming over here being exploited, and there are a pretty good number of those. But how, and there are a bunch of these different classifications of visas, but I'm curious about the H-2A visas. How large is this?
Well, last year there were 86,000 workers who were brought to the United States under these H-2A work, under this H-2A program. And this H-2A program is just for agriculture. In other words, there are other programs that supply workers for, you know, working in hospitals, even teachers, some of them, and then the people who plant trees in the forest for, you know, making paper, those are guest workers. And of course, in Pennsylvania, you do have the experience of those students who went to work for Hershey's and actually went out on strike, you know, bless their souls. So there are a lot of other programs. If you total all together the number of people who are coming to the United States under these contract labor programs, some estimates are as high as 900,000 people.
Wow.
But what's even more significant, Rick, is that in the immigration reform proposal that passed through the Senate, which is a very, very employer-dominated proposal, in this proposal, the number of agricultural guest workers would go up to approximately 337,000 workers. So it would more than quadruple, and wages would go down.
I mean, it would wipe out any organizing that's been going on, and it would probably destroy any of the contracts that, and any of the agreements that are in place now. That would throw that all into chaos.
Well, it would give the growers a big hammer over the head of workers. You know, it would give them a supply of very, very vulnerable people and hundreds of thousands of them. And in addition, you know, right now under the H-2A program, as bad as it is, the U.S. Department of Labor sets a wage rate state by state that determines what basically what they call a wage that wouldn't undermine the wages in the particular local area. So Washington State, as it turns out, actually has one of the highest. It has a $12 an hour wage for these guest workers, which I know it sounds like a lot for farm labor, but when you think that people are going to have to support themselves for, you know, 3 or 4 months at least in the winter without work, you can see that $12 an hour isn't going to go very far. In any case, in the Senate bill, for these 337,000 agricultural workers that they're talking about bringing in as guest workers, that wage is going to go down to $9.64 an hour. So there's going to be a better than a $2 an hour, almost a $3 an hour wage cut as a result of this bill.
And who pockets that difference? Because you know it's not going to be you. It's not going to be you. It's not going to be me. It's not going to be the consumer.
Absolutely not. You're not going to see the price of vegetables go down. You're not going to see Haagen-Dazs cut the price of this ice cream because they don't have to pay as much for the berries anymore. Basically, this is going to go into the pockets of big business, really.
And what could be more American than that?
Well, of course, of course. But what could also be more American than the right to strike? And that's what these workers up in Washington State have been exercising. You know, they didn't have much outside assistance. There was a local community organization called Community to Community that helped them. But generally speaking, These workers organized themselves. They formed a committee that was called Familias Unidas para la Justicia, which means Families United for Justice. And they were able to force the company to talk to them. They were able to get some improvements in the conditions in the labor camp. Somebody who had been fired for asking for a wage raise, they got the company to rehire them. So they are doing what workers in this country have always done, which is to organize themselves and to try and get something better. It's just that this guest worker program, as it exists right now, and especially as it may exist in the future with this enormous expansion, it's really stacking the odds against them. It's not helping these workers to go out on strike. It's not helping them to get better wages. It's undermining the efforts that they've made themselves in order to improve their own condition.
And I think the American people understand that as well. I saw a poll recently that put something like three-quarters of the respondents to the poll in opposition of a guest worker program. So I think the mass of Americans and American workers get that this is a rigged game that we can only lose from.
That's right. And I think, as you said at the beginning of this segment here, Rick, you know, what we want is an immigration policy that respects people as human beings, that gives people the chance to live here, that gives people the chance to have families, that respects people's communities, their right to strike, instead of setting up an immigration system whose main purpose is to supply labor to employers at the lowest possible rate. You know, we need a rational, pro-person, pro-immigrant, pro-family immigration policy, and not one that is basically a labor supply program for growers.
And that's been the sad thing about our immigration policy. It's been how much cheap labor can we get for big business to pocket the proceeds and stagnate wages for everybody else?
Yeah, we need something that's based on rights. I think the first question as working people and as trade unionists we ought to ask ourselves is, what kind of arrangement do we want to have that is going to increase the rights of everybody, whether you were born in some other country or whether you were born here? We all basically have the same needs, which is higher wages, more secure jobs, you know, the right to strike, all of these things. So we need an immigration policy that basically makes that easier for people rather than stacking the odds against people in the interests of essentially corporate profit.
Let me ask you a last line of question. I understand you've got a book out published by Beacon Press called The Right to Stay Home. Tell me about it.
Well, this book is about what exactly we've been talking about here. In Mexico, where these workers are coming from, people are talking about trying to find alternatives to the poverty that basically forces people to leave home. And so this book starts by talking about how people are trying to find these alternatives and trying to organize for political change in Mexico, and then how that's connected to the efforts by immigrant workers to organize unions and to organize themselves in this country here. So both of these things are parts of what I would say is a rational, pro-person immigration policy that's based on human rights.
And I would assume a good portion of that has to do with our insane trade policies, NAFTA, and the soon-to-be-coming Trans-Pacific Partnership. I'm sure not going to make things any better.
No, that's absolutely right, Rick, because that's what the source is of a lot of the poverty abroad that forces people to leave home. You know, in the case of Mexico, we have NAFTA that basically lowered wages and dumped corn on the Mexican market so that farmers couldn't survive. You know, broke union, helped employers to break unions in Mexico, put this enormous economic pressure on people to leave home. So we need to change our trade policy as part of any immigration policy, because otherwise we're not really looking at what the roots of migration really are.
Yeah, we basically did to Mexico what we've done to our urban centers, created mass amounts of poverty, and then left them with a drug culture, and that's about it.
That's right. That's right. And that also shows you what we have in common. You know, whether we live in Mexico or we live here, or whether we're migrants or we're people who are living in the same town that our grandparents were born in, we basically have the same problem. We have the same needs, and we are confronting the same people who are making life difficult for all of us.
Yep. David, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick. It's always a pleasure talking to you, too.
The book's called The Right to Stay Home, written by David Bacon, freelance writer and photojournalist. We'll get a link up at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on David's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
realizing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the Anti-Immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours, in a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.theRickSmithShow.com.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. So Cumberland County Commissioners, they have approved a loan to a contestant on the BBC series Chef Race UK versus US. They're giving Pipa Calland, giving her $35,000 from the Federal Community and Economic Development grant money to open her new business called the Mid-State Taco. Going to put it over at the West Shore Farmers Market. And I look at this and I go, you know what? I'm actually not against it. This is creating a new business. This isn't stealing it for somewhere else. I'm okay with investing in someone who wants to start a new business. And I'm also not against the idea of the state lending money. And this is lending money. It's a loan. They didn't just say, here's $35,000. Good luck. Really low interest loan, 2% evidently, will be the rate of interest. Now, the other part of this had to put up equal amount of money of her own money, so a $70,000 project, you know, could lead to something. Who knows? Because there's a bunch of costs that go along with it. You need a ventilating system, you need a broiler, you need, you know, all kinds of stuff, steamers, you know, all the stuff that you're going to need to make a little restaurant. I'm not against it. You know, because people say, wow, you're anti-business. You point out that we gave millions of dollars to a huge, to a multinational defense contractor to move, you know, I forget how many jobs moved across the river into Pennsylvania from New Jersey that are already filled. I mean, there are no new jobs yet, so don't go jumping for joy because, oh, the more jobs governor created jobs. No, he didn't. He just brought a couple from somewhere else here that are already full. Not against the idea of government going, you know what, we can borrow money almost free. We can float a bond initiative almost free. I'm not against the idea of doing that and saying, okay, we're going to loan some of that out to people who are going to start businesses and eventually hire people. Seems fairly reasonable to me. According to reports, the loan is conditional in that the business create at least one full-time job before the loan closes. According to the reports, Ms. Caland says she's going to hire three people. There'll be three full-time employees when the Mid-State Taco opens up, and hoping to have five within the first year. So good for her. I don't eat tacos, but, you know, who would love to see it. You know, a second ago we were talking about the corn situation there in Mexico. And if you don't know, when we passed NAFTA, one of the things that had to happen in order for Mexico to sign on to NAFTA was they had to change their constitution. So one of those things that I bring up often because I think it's extraordinarily important. They had to change their constitution to take land away from communities because under their old constitution, each community was given a plot of land as a communal farm to where you could grow food for the community so that at least during economic hard times, you would have the ability to feed yourself. Well, according to NAFTA, that's an unfair trade barrier. If you're giving free land to people, that's a subsidy can't have. Never mind our farm bill. Never mind that, but free land to the people, can't have it done. So they changed their constitution, stole the land away, and the floodgates open, and the entire farming community in Mexico is wiped out almost immediately. Why? Well, because U.S. agribusiness came in, flooded the market with cheap corn. In fact, so cheap you couldn't even buy the seeds that you would need to grow the corn. You couldn't even buy the seeds as cheaply as you could buy finished product from the U.S. And it basically pushed all those farmers north to the maquiladoras. There wasn't enough work there because, you know, as the U.S. companies were moving south into those areas, there were still more people than the jobs could fill. Wages were falling there as well because of the glut of employment. And those folks were going, hey, we got to keep moving up. Got kids to feed, got things we've got to take care of. So we created our own problems by pandering to the very wealthy. And I see this again with the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Politico had an interesting article on it, which, you know, you got to give them credit, at least they're talking about it. But they're talking about it from the frame that it might be held up because of, well, big sugar. Yes, it was big sugar! Because the sugar folks are not happy that they want to open up the border with Australia, because right now, Australia, they can only import about 89,000 tons of cane sugar before tariffs go into effect. Now understand, here in the U.S., we consume in excess of 10 million tons of sugar, per year. So we've sort of picked out and, you know, kind of saved that industry for ourselves and some other countries that we deal with. Australia is the eighth largest producer of sugar in the world. They produce right around 3.5 a year. So they want access to our markets. Big Sugar says no. And Big Sugar seems to be putting out their muscle. The American Sugar Alliance, which if I remember right, they're the people who wanted to change the name. One of the folks who fought the changing of the corn sugar name. So they're actually pretty powerful, now that I think about it. But the sad reality is the winds are moving forward, because, well, big business wants this. You know, Nike wants it. You know, you saw a push from Vietnam wanting to ship more T-shirts and shoes and apparel here to the U.S. And who's behind that? Well, of course, Nike, because that's where they're moving all of their production. There are a number of other countries that are just chomping at the bit to get into our markets. And flood, which means the end of some of our industries. And what I find interesting is, and it's one of those things that just leaves you kind of scratching your head. What I find interesting is one of the things that the guy who was interviewed for this, he was former head of the WTO. One of the things that he said that was an obstacle was, you know, people who wanted to have procurement plans like buy local. That was a big sticking point because, you know, I guess it would be a violation of the trade agreement. Now, we don't know because we're not one of the 600 lobbyists who have access to this, but we don't know. But according to the report, is, you know, a big hurdle is this buy local procurement policy that a lot of countries have, and I would love to see us have. And that flies in the face of what they're trying to do, which is basically no borders. And wherever the cheapest production is, that's where it's going to go. And there's this belief, and it comes out in this article, that, you know, people want, people believe that if we have no barriers, there's no tariffs, you're going to have, you know, more trade and all of this, we're going to create more jobs. And in fact, they claim that the 12 country deal is going to boost our exports and create jobs. In fact, they say by 2025, we should have exports grow by $124 billion. And I go, okay, well, that sounds great. How much are we importing? I mean, that's the thing here, because I go back and I look at our trade deficits, which kind of mirror our budget deficits. I mean, we're buying so much from other places that we're actually selling our souls for what we think are cheap goods. And there's this blind belief that there's this blind belief that open markets are going to be good for us when all we see are lower wages and lower opportunities. The other thing that caught my attention in the article, which is, you know, a difference between us and other countries like New Zealand, it pointed out that on data issues, on big data issues, actually, there are some cultural differences that are just not going to be easy to overcome, according to the guy, the former head of the WTO. He said that New Zealand citizens tend to trust their government with their information, but dislike handing personal details over to private companies, where here in the U.S., the opposite is true. And it's something I've been talking about for years, that, you know, we don't seem to mind when Home Depot has all of our information. But boy, we're in fury, we're angry when our government asks a question. Just an interesting thought. But I'm waiting for this Trans-Pacific Partnership free trade agreement to come up. Hopefully, as the article points out, the longer it takes into the next election cycle, the less likely it's going to pass. I'm not in favor of it. I think these trade agreements are horrible. I think they've contributed mightily to the inequality. They've contributed mightily to the drain of the middle class in this country. But it has created a very large wealth class. And they're happy with it. Anyway, going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show.
The voters, damn them, have got to be subverted. You won't find that autocratic principle taught in any civics class, but it's one that America's corporate powers openly embrace when local democracy offends them. Just ask the voters of Orlando, Florida, who recently felt the sting of such arrogance. A grassroots coalition called Organize Now had collected 50,000 signatures last year to put an earned sick time referendum on their county's November ballot. It was to be a citizens' vote on whether employers should let workers earn a few days each year of paid leave to be used if they fall ill or must care for a sick family member. Whoa, shouted the bosses of Disney World, Olive Garden, Red Lobster, and other super wealthy, low-wage corporations in Orlando that provide minimal or no benefits. We can't allow that. So they leaned on the county commissioners to knock the referendum off the ballot. However, the scrappy Organize Now bunch took them to court and won. The people's victory was too late for last year's election, though, so the court ordered that the referendum be put on the 2014 ballot. So, all set, right? Not so fast, shouted the corporate powers as they scuttled off to Tallahassee, demanding that the GOP governor and state legislative leaders deliver a, quote, kill shot to those pesky voters back in Orlando. Sure enough, the obsequious corporate-hugging politicos obliged in June by enacting a brutish, democracy-smashing law called state preemption. It autocratically usurps the right of local governments and local voters to enact paid sick leave benefits. This is Jim Hightower saying, still, it's not over, for the corporate subversion of the people is not real popular and maybe not even legal. Organize Now is pushing back and pushing ahead. Keep up with them at www.orgnow.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Well, the big news yesterday was the release of the birth certificate. Well, Ted Cruz released his birth certificate. Turns out Ted was born in Canada. I actually didn't know that. He holds dual citizenship. And what was interesting about the article that I read on it is they claim that he can run for president. He can be president or he can run for the Canadian Parliament, which I'm not so sure about the president part. But, you know, with our today's journalism, the fact doesn't really quite matter. Anyway, here to talk about that and what else is going on around the world, I've got Evan Ratner, Talk Radio News.
Well, you know, I'm not quite sure why he can run unless he was there doing government, his parents were there doing government work, in which case it doesn't matter where in the world you're sort of born.
Well, they claim that, the article claims that his mother was an American citizen, so that automatically makes him an American citizen, which is true, but I thought you had to be, and a lot of this came up during the McCain, Obama
right,
election.
Right, because his family was in
Panama.
Mexico doing, but he was born, I believe, on a base.
Right, he was in Panama, and he was born in a base in Panama. But there was still a question because no other U.S. president has been born outside of the 50 states, according to many of the reports. I wasn't sure where Washington was born off the top of my head, but I would have thought he'd have been the only one. The rest of them born in the, you know, the continent here.
Right.
Right here in the U.S., not in Canada, which, of course, part of North
well,
America.
Well, if Ted Cruz thinks he can do it, he's going to try and run. Trust
They
all look at
that.
Themselves in the mirror, and they say they're the next president of the United States.
And I would love to see that. I'd love to see him and Rand Paul on the same stage. And why not throw in Rick Perry and a whole bunch of – bring Michelle Bachmann back. Let's have Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs all over again.
Ha. Huh.
Because I loved 2012. That was just pure joy. I missed it.
Well, I'm hearing from very reliable sources that Christie is running. They
of course
think
he is.
He's going to get the nomination.
Of course he's going to run. I mean, he's doing everything he can possibly do to center himself, I think.
Well, you know, today he decided that that
gay conversion therapy.
That's right. It's not going to... if you're a licensed therapist in the state of New Jersey, you cannot use conversion therapy on adolescents. Now, he did that because, of course, he voted against gay marriage for civil unions, and he knows he has to appeal to the gays in order to get elected.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the end of this, I look at it and I go, what rational, sane thoughtful person would think that this would work. You are who you are. To me, it's that simple.
And yeah, that's right.
But you know, it's this idea that we can change things and we have control over everything that I think some of these radical right wingers really, really buy into.
Well, listen, radical right wingers make a habit of trying to swim against stream, and they think that they can successfully do it. And that's the problem with Chris Christie as a possible candidate. I don't know how he does against some of these loony tunes in this part.
And generally what I find are the people who are out there screaming the loudest, and this has just been my experience, you know, no one else has to agree with me. My experience has been the person who's screaming the loudest against something is generally the person who's doing it. And you look at Ted Haggard. Remember Pastor Ted?
Yes, I do.
The good evangelical who pushed for a law almost making homosexuality illegal. Well, didn't they find him sniffing crack off the backside of a male hooker?
I think they did.
Yes, they did. And again, you know, it's the guy out there screaming the loudest who's the one who's doing it.
Well, that's, you know, we've actually found that same problem in South Sudan, actually. We had a young pastor who was not married. He refused to look after my kid, even though we were paying him pretty handsomely, $250 a month, which is a lot in South Sudan, to do that. And he all of a sudden sort of disappeared, and, you know, and he was screaming the loudest about Uganda and the gay thing.
Yep. Because he just tried to deflect. I mean,
and we're almost sure that the reason he refused to take care of my kid is because my kid was bored.
Wow. Sad stuff. How are things going? I know you do an awful lot of work there. How are things
I'm going there again at the end of September. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've talked about it with my wife that I would love to go with you.
Well, we'd love to have you come.
Yeah, she's against the idea.
Oh.
She goes, you flying 100 hours in a very small plane? Good luck on that.
Okay.
But I would love to. Oh, it's one of those experiences that you don't get. You get maybe once in a lifetime. Anyway, let's move.
You're like me, and you get it four times a year.
Well, good point.
Right.
Let's move along. What's going on in Egypt?
Well, in Egypt, it looks like Hosni Mubarak, the former president before this most recent president who was in jail, they dismissed charges on one thing. They want to keep him in jail for 15 more days to see if they will bring charges or charges work on another. We'll see what happens. But the most recent president, we have no idea where he is. Of course, he was supported by the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah. A lot of insanity going on there. And I saw over the weekend that the military said that they're going to clamp down, really?
Well, they've been clamping down, and the question is, how much do we support it? And was it really a coup d'etat? Yes, it was.
Yes.
So then what? We supposedly don't support coup d'etat.
And I guess it's just the semantics of the definition of the word, so that we're going to continue to fund it. And I got to be honest, there's part of me that says we stay the hell out of it.
Well, I think so too, and I think a lot of people are doing that. And if I lose you, I'm in a tunnel.
Yeah, don't lose me, because I got a couple other questions I wanted to
get
to.
All right, go for it.
The budget cuts. The Screwquester going to end, going to eliminate Head Start services for more
18,000 jobs.
Mission accomplished.
I mean, that's what they're losing. What do they think they're going to get from this?
They're going to get people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, Ellen. Those kids don't need Head Start. Head Start's just that's just glorified babysitting, don't you know?
Right, and we all know that if you don't develop those neural pathways between 0 and 5, you're not going to get them.
Oh, big word. Use your 50-cent word, neural pathways.
You like it? Big word.
Well, I mean, that's what the right wing would say. That's just glorified babysitting, and that's a big word I don't understand, so I don't agree with you.
Well, it's a very, very big problem. And where do they think those 18,000 people are going to work?
Don't care. I mean, we got 20,000 education professionals here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania that this governor has kicked to the curb by defunding public education. Do they care? No. They call him the more jobs governor because he gives millions of dollars, well, actually billions of dollars, to companies to move across the border and bring jobs with them. along with their employees, never mind actually creating jobs in the Commonwealth. But the more jobs, Governor, yes, more than Wyoming. Give him credit for that. He's running for re-election. But you'll love this. I'm sure you probably didn't hear about this. But our governor, who, you know, proud Pennsylvania, believes in Pennsylvania tourism, out there pimping that whenever he gets a chance. In fact, he was kayaking not too long ago when one of the local townships had a shooting in their township building. Didn't bother to mention that. But he bought a house in South Carolina. It seems to me he's planning on losing next year and going to flee to South Carolina.
Wait a minute. The governor of Pennsylvania bought a house in South Carolina. Does he have a tin ear?
No, he bought a vacation spot, $265,000 little place for himself and his wife, Susan, but didn't bother to disclose it to anyone. Didn't understand the form. Now, here's a former attorney general. The guy who oversaw this stuff as attorney general didn't understand the form, didn't realize that he would have to actually disclose that. The form was confusing, Ellen.
The press isn't having a field day with it?
Well, not really.
I'm shocked.
I am, but, you know, look. You know.
I'm surprised. That is something that I would expect the local press would go nuts about in Pennsylvania.
Well, our local newspaper went down to 3 days a week, so you know, there's only so much they can do.
Oh, wow.
You know, budget cuts and all.
How about the Philadelphia Inquirer?
They're going after it a little bit, but nothing here in the state capital.
Wow.
Anyway.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
And the other thing was when he started getting a little flack for saying he didn't understand the form when he was the former attorney general, he said that, well, his spokesperson said, well, we hadn't finished closing, at the time when we filled out the paperwork. Hide much?
I just don't know what a governor does. I mean, forget the form, which is bad, really bad. But how does a governor of a state buy a place somewhere else they're governor?
I think that's why they didn't disclose it.
I would say not.
And you know,
it's shocking. It's shocking.
Well, no, it's not. It's not surprising coming out of Punxsutawney Phom.
How would you like the president of the United States
to buy a house in Kenya?
Yeah, exactly.
If I were him, I would, just to send the right wing into a tizzy. In fact, we should buy him a house in Kenya. Anyway, the U.S. government's looking for a sentencing into Bradley Manning.
Yes, they're looking at Bradley Manning in for 60 years.
60
I mean,
years.
Give me a break. I don't think they're going to get it. I hope they don't get it. That's outrageous.
I hope they let him go with time served. I got to tell you why. For a moment, I listened to his plea to the judge, you know, this whole thing with gender identity or whatever the hell he was talking about. And I got to be honest, you know, initially I'm like, wow, that was kind of a cop-out. You should have stood your ground and said, I did the right thing. But then I thought about 3 years of torture, 3 years of being put in solitary confinement, held naked, standing, doing the torture that they did to this kid.
Exactly.
You're pliable, and you will say anything. And they've got to figure out a way to make this about something other than the fact that this kid, I think, did the right thing.
Listen, I do not disagree with you, and I would hope the judge sees it that way, but we'll see. Yeah. When does he get sentenced? Tomorrow, I think, or the next day?
It's coming up this week.
Yeah.
I think it's tomorrow.
Right.
The judge will start deliberations tomorrow, I believe.
Right.
Crazy.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Also, the Keystone XL, what's going on there?
Well, it looks like the Interior Department has found some major faults around environmental issues, lighting, a lot of things. And at this point, they're not recommending that the Keystone pipeline goes through. The right will have a bird about it.
Yeah. I've been seeing a bunch
of talk. Probably lay a pipeline, they'll be so flipped out.
I've been seeing a bunch of talk from Republican operatives saying, this is how we divide the, you know, like the Democrats have been doing to Republicans on immigration and anything sane or rational. Republicans see this as the opportunity to divide the Democrats, especially here in Pennsylvania, because the state caucus, the Democratic state caucus, they voted to ban fracking. And a number of the state Democrats are like, whoa, 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 let's not ban fracking. Because it's helping our area. So there's kind of a divide here, and I see that divide is national. That's where Republicans, I think, are going to continue.
Wow, amazing.
Did you see the huge explosion?
It'll be very interesting to see what they do if the president says we are not going ahead with it.
Yeah, I have no idea. Did you see that big explosion? I think it was last Thursday in Illinois. One of the gas lines ruptured and I guess burned for, it was a huge explosion. There was a video someone sent me that you could see this guy was like 5 miles away and it just lit up the sky. In fact, the airplanes were reporting it from, you know, like 20,000 feet that they could see this massive ball of fire.
I don't know how I missed that.
That was huge. And finally, the big story around Glenn Greenwald and the Guardian journalist.
Well, this is outrageous. And not, the White House had, basically, as you know, they detained him for 9 hours. He was Glenn Greenwald's writing partner, lives with Glenn Greenwald. They're not homosexual. He happens to be heterosexual. But they detained him. They took his electronics. The United States would not say whether they were purview to what was on those electronics.
But they said they weren't behind it.
Well, they said they did not make this happen. That's correct.
Just like they said they weren't behind the coup in 53 in Iran, but now the CIA says, well, yeah, we did that.
Right, of course. Of course. And you know they connected with their British counterparts on this. Please.
Yeah. Could be any one of us, Ellen.
It could be any one of us, for sure.
That's why I'm outraged.
Right, and me too. You and I think alike.
Sad, sad stuff. We better wake up. You know, I had a friend of mine today was telling me she was doing some research for our book, and she said that because we had gone through Blair, West Virginia, and she pointed out that the mayor and the sheriff of the town of Blair got killed because when they called for warrants, the people who were you know, patching the phone calls through,
right,
told the coal companies that they were calling. And, you know, the more things changed, the more they kind of stayed the same. The old day NSA.
Wow.
The telephone operators.
I tell you, it's really scary. And this Glenn Greenwald and his partner and what they're doing to them is very, very frightening.
Well, at least he'll have something hopefully to write about.
I think he's got a lot to write about.
All right, Ellen. It's always great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
Thank you so much.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Never you will look back again. We fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. In the plan we have defended from all things dark and cruel.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized, and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the 8-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, 8 innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. 4 of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Smith Show.
Someone tell the GOP that Ohio's not for sale. So we're singing, hey, John Kasich, don't sell us out. Hey, Ohio, stand up and shout.
Come on, Kasich.
Oh, yeah, he could be 2016 Republican presidential nominee, John Kasich. No. I don't think so. Now, Kasich does do a little bit better than some of the in-state Republicans in Ohio. Not as good as Christie or Paul or even Romney. And I think that's just because people remember Romney's name. Not that he'll run again. But in Ohio, Kasich loses to Hillary. I'm all in favor of Kasich being the guy. Don't think so. I think at this point, Christie is the guy. Even if he is doing some censorious things like the banning of gay conversion therapy, which I think is just dumb and a huge waste of time. But Christie's still trying to look like he's the moderate. According to him, the issue, he says, I believe that exposing children to these health risks without clear evidence of benefits, that outweigh the serious risks is not appropriate. So there you go. Chris Christie in 2016. I got to be honest, though. I'm really hoping for a very long, drawn-out Republican brawl like we saw last time around. A couple of quick stories that caught my attention. Australian baseball player. Kid came here on a scholarship to go to college in Oklahoma, doing a little jogging down the street. Evidently that caught the ire of three teenagers who shot him in the back and killed him. Welcome to America. I guess it is what it is. Another gun story. You gotta love the gun stories. More on, guns. 4-year-old kid shot himself with a gun that, evidently he was just playing with the gun. A friend of the family has been arrested. The story didn't say what for. I would think in Michigan, just having a gun laying around is not a crime, even if a 4-year-old does shoot himself in the head. Sad, sad story. And finally, from Pittsburgh, a woman has been arrested. 38-year-old woman has been arrested and charged with child endangerment for wiping feces on her infant and telling the doctor that the kid is sick. Evidently, she's been one of these people, the hero complex. What is it? Munchausen by proxy. She's on camera taking dirty linens and soiling the child and putting it up the kid's nose. That's just wrong. And I'm in favor of beatings for her. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone. Email me, rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous.